Revenue Committee, at least again, the left flank of the House Revenue Committee. We have bills up for public hearing today. I apologize for the vacant seats up here. We have one member out with a personal family emergency, three members who are testifying on bills in other committees, and so they will be along. But with a room full here and some people on schedules, I didn't want to further delay the start of our committee work down here. So we will begin with House Bill 2652, and from DEQ, that Holly Schroeder? Are you the one who needed to be on her way? Okay, that's what I wanted to do. Elizabeth, would you please give us the review overview on House Bill 2652 as I open a public hearing?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin-Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. And this bill basically is has some revisions to the pollution control credit. And it's specifying that there is to be allowed an animal feeding operations to be considered a pollution control facility. This is already in law, only in a different location. This transfers the authority of administering the pollution tax credit to the Economic and Community Development Department from the Department of Environmental Quality, where it is right now. It is also deleting the filing deadline for the credit of December 31st, 2008. It outlines then some of the responsibilities of the Economic Community Development Department, who would be administering the program in conjunction with the Department of Environmental Quality to certify the cost of the facility. It's deleting the pollution control credit sunset date of December 31st, 2007. It increases the lower tier credit percentage from 15% to 40% of the certified cost of the pollution control facility. It increases the top tier credit percentage from 35% to 50% of the certified cost of the pollution control facility for facilities that were certified on or after January 1st, 2003. It specifies that the Department of Environmental Quality will notify applicants of any deficiencies in their applications for the pollution control certification. It specifies the Department of Environmental Quality shall transfer all pending applications for pre-certification to Economic Community Development Department. So this, I'm sure the staff will go through some of the background on this pollution control facility credit and the changes that came about last session. But basically with the revenue impact, what you have now is they've grandfathered in quite a few different facilities that already have a 50% credit. So this is basically is only affecting those that came into effect in 2002, 2003 that weren't grandfathered in. So this has a progressive revenue impact of roughly $373,349 in 2003-05 biennium. $656,603 reduction in the 05-07 biennium, and then when you add in the sunset and things that is in place in statute and in 07-09 biennium, you have $10.6 million reduction in revenue.
All right, thank you very much, Ms. Schroeder.
Sure.
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Holly Schroeder. I'm the administrator of the Office of Budget and Finance at DEQ, and that includes the administration of the Pollution Control Facilities Tax Credit Program. I'm here today to testify solely on the portion of the bill that describes the transfer from DEQ to the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. DEQ at this time does not support this transfer. DEQ has been administering this program for many years, and we feel that it is, while it does have economic incentives for business, the program is also a pollution control mechanism for the department to use. We refer to it as we like to have many tools in our toolbox, and this is one of them. And we believe that because the administration of the law requires you to know something about pollution control law and pollution control issues, then that expertise rests with the department, that it's appropriate for the administration to remain with DEQ. Because of the knowledge that we have, we've been able to see applications of the tax credit, opportunities for that because of our work. For example, I give in my written testimony an example of the retrofitting of diesel engines. It's been an issue that we've been working on, and we were able to, as part of working on that issue, to use this as one of the tools in our toolbox. I have included with my testimony a fact sheet on the tax credit, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions for Ms. Schroeder. I'm sure we'll hear some testimony contrary. It is favoring the transfer, but I wanted to give you the opportunity to come in first. Do you want to touch at all on the tax credit fact sheet that you put on the back of your testimony?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The fact sheet is just it's our basic summary fact sheet of the tax credit, describing the mechanisms of who is eligible for the tax credit. It is a very complicated law, but if you look on the right-hand column, it gives you an idea of the types of facilities that are eligible for the tax credit. And the tax credit is eligible to businesses who install both pollution control devices that are required by law from DEQ or from the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as for facilities that install pollution control devices that are not required by law.
And this fact sheet is current as of the legislative changes from the 2001 session?
That is correct, sir.
Representative Virgil, do you have a question?
I do. Were you made aware earlier, or perhaps you weren't, was the department made aware earlier that this thought process was going through of shifting from one department to another for the responsibility of pollution control tax credit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, my understanding is it's a concept that has been discussed on and off for some time. We have had some discussions with stakeholders prior to this, although I would not say that they've been extensive at this time. I can appreciate the fact that there is certainly a economic incentive component of the pollution control tax facilities tax credit law, and yet because of the expertise required to administer that law and to the knowledge of the environmental regulations that is needed in determining what components of a pollution control facility are eligible for the tax credit, that's something that is more appropriately placed within the department.
Mr. Chairman. Was the economic aspect the only reason given to you that you know of for the transfer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Virgil, to my knowledge, that is all that's been communicated to me.
We'll hear from the proponents on that. Any other questions for Ms. Schroeder? All right, we'll let you get on your way. Thank you for stopping down. While we're on the subject, let's bring up John Ledger and Mark Nelson. And they are the only other two that I have signed up to testify on this, so if there are others, be ready to raise your hand before when they get done. Yeah, that's, I mean, out there.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. I'm John Ledger with Associated Oregon Industries. I was wondering if we could have I can't tell if the projector is on. There we go. Can you push that up a bit?
Kathy, are you going to bring the lights down?
The Pollution Control Tax Credit Program, just to give you a very quick background on it, was established by Governor McCaul in the late 60s under similar circumstances. The state was in bad shape financially, and there was a great interest in doing environmental cleanup, especially on the Willamette River. And so it kind of coupled economic development and environmental protection at the same time. And now looking back, we would say this was one of the first sustainability bills, although they didn't use that word at that time. But it was started. It's been in place. It's been modified since then. Normally, it's been extended in time around periods in about 10-year increments, although those have been getting shorter. The program provides an economic incentive for companies to expand and build. Because environmental control costs are one of the most expensive costs. It encourages them to locate here, gives them a little bit of an advantage over other states. This is important because we used to have power as a chief advantage, and we don't have that anymore. That's gone. And it's also an incentive to help clean up the environment and modify your plant early, because when you modify your plant, you have to meet more strict environmental standards. So if you can do that more cheaply, that improves the environment too. I put this chart up to show you what has been happening on this, because there have been a lot of numbers thrown around. There's quite a difference between the credits that are awarded and the credits that are consumed. And the credits that are awarded, it goes up and down dramatically each year. But when you get a credit, you take it over a period of 10 to 13 years. So they kind of overlay on each other and flatten the curve out. This is a chart from a revenue department showing the credits that are actually cashed in and by year. And you can see it's been going down steadily since 84, probably because our manufacturing base has been dropping substantially since that time. And we don't have the numbers yet for 2001, 2002, but just looking at the curve, it's probably under 9 million. This is all based on the old 50% tax credit rate before the new program was kicked in. This bill that you have before you does several things. One that you've already heard of is it does move the program from the Department of Environmental Quality to Economic Development. And part of that sort of reflects the revisions that were made in the program last session. Last session was really the biggest rework of this program in many years, and it essentially established a two-tier system. The lower tier was for construction. You built something, you got a 35% credit on your capital costs. And then if you went and met certain extra requirements that are specified in the law, you got to go up to 25% normally as a base. If you do extra good things, you get to go up to 35%. So you had the 25% as an economic base, and you had the 35% as an overlay when you'd met certain environmental requirements. And the way we configured it in this bill is that the Economic Development Department would handle the first 25%. That is, if you weren't claiming an extra bump for environmental bonuses, that's the economic piece. And if you are claiming an extra percentage for economic bonuses, then under the bill, it gets referred over to the DEQ for them to evaluate that because they have the expertise in that. So it sort of simplifies it. And that is, if you're just applying for the economic benefit part of construction, that's done by economic development. And if you're going for the extra percentage because of environmental improvements, like you have a green permit or something like this, that gets referred over to DEQ. The total cost of the program is still borne by the applicant, top to bottom.
John, do you have at least some sense of the breakdown in numbers between applications, let's say it would fall under the 25% and it would fall above that? That is, the breakdown then, what would be between DEQ and what would be between economic development?
Mr. Chairman, right now I do not. And the program has just been changed, yeah. So we really haven't seen
okay.
that. I can say that the ones that would go over to DEQ would tend to be the ones that were submitted by larger, tending to be more sophisticated operations, because they're going to be the ones that have an environmental management system or a green permit or something like this. So typically, the larger, more sophisticated ones would flip over to the DEQ, and the simpler, more straightforward construction projects would probably not, I think, as a rule of thumb. One of the reasons we looked at moving this to economic development for several reasons. One is that the stress of the bill, especially since the change, I think, reflects more of an economic development angle to it. For instance, you go into the higher tier if you're going to construct in an economically depressed area. And the other is that we know the Department of Economic Development supports this program very strongly, thinks it's a valuable program, good to have. And the third reason is that the Environmental Quality Commission's response to this program in the past has been less than enthusiastic. And so we're, in a sense, we've seen the bill shift more to economic development. We also feel that's a department that is more amenable to the program, frankly. The bill does some other things. It does remove the sunsets. And briefly, the reason why this is important is this. If somebody is going to decide to locate a facility somewhere and they look to see where they're going to locate it, and they look at this program, it becomes evident you do not get the credit until after you're done construction. This is something where you have to go do something, build something, hire people, then you get the credit. So if the sunset on the program is tight, You figure a company, especially if it's going to be large, is going to say, well, should we consider moving to Oregon or expanding in Oregon? You start penciling it out. You start looking at the finances. You do the design work. You get the permits, which could take, you know, who knows how long. And then you start to construct it. And then, after you're done constructing, then you apply for the credit. So the credit has to be there for you fairly far out, or it's not an incentive, at least for major projects. The other piece is, if you are going to locate a major facility in Oregon or keep one here as opposed to somewhere else, knowing the credit will be there for you if you decide to modify or expand in future years, maybe 10 years, maybe 15, that's of considerable value. That's an advantage we would have over other states. Also, in the bill, it does change the percentage tiers. What is happening now under this kind of two- or three-tiered system is that some companies will qualify for the 25% tier, the lower tier. That cuts off, I think, the end of this year, and then it becomes a 15% tier and then disappears, I think, in about a year or two after that. So we're actually looking at some parts of this program sunsetting as early as 2 years out, and the higher tier sunsets, I think, at the end of 07. And so both of those are actually fairly tight if you're looking at constructing something substantial, or you're looking at where you're going to keep a facility open versus another one somewhere else in the country. So we think taking those sunsets off would be a big improvement. It does change the percentages, takes the 35%, moves it back up to 50, where it has been since Tom McCall's time, and it takes the lower percentage and moves it to 40. And again, it's two-tiered. You only qualify for the higher tier if you meet certain requirements, like you have a green permit, you're in an economically depressed zone, or you're ISO certified 2000 or something like that. So you have to qualify for it. The nub of this is that Oregon used to be able to attract manufacturing and keep manufacturing for various reasons. One, there was a lot of timber to cut. That's disappeared a bit on us. A big one was low power rates. Those are gone probably forever. So when we're looking at keeping companies here, we have to have some type of incentive that will keep them here. And if somebody owns, say, several facilities around the country and they're looking at closing one of them and merging their operations in another one, and they have operations, say, here, Georgia, Minnesota, someplace else, we would prefer them to close the one in Georgia and put those people out of work rather than Oregonians. That's kind of what it boils down to. A lot of these credits are also used by very small operations. Half of the credits that are issued for under $20,000. So a lot of them go to small businesses that are doing stuff with tanks, auto shops, that type of thing. So it's a real benefit to small businesses also. And that's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Christian. John, if you could, maybe for committee, I know we worked on this in depth last session. But one of the elements that you talked about in the work on last session was this two-tier approach. You have a lower percentage. Right now it's 25 going to 15, and then you have a higher percentage. For the committee, it might be helpful if you could, either on page, well, let's look at the bold print, page 8, kind of walk through those elements that would qualify an application for the top tier, because some of that is not self-explanatory for members who haven't worked with green permits or ISO standard 14001, those
sure.
kinds of things. If you could just give us a sense of what those
Happy
are.
Happy to. Just real quickly, in IS on A, which is line 27, ISO 14001 is an international certification program. It's actually, I believe, out of Switzerland. And it is used by companies that do international business. And a lot of companies, for instance, in Europe say, if you want to do business with us, you have to be ISO certified at a certain level. And what you have to do to get ISO certified, it's difficult. I think there are only half dozen, if that. in the state is have like an environmental system that's completely integrated into your facility, top to bottom. What you purchase, how you do your management, all your management decisions involve environmental issues, community involvement. It's very difficult to get. But if you want to do big time international business, you have to have an ISO certification. A green permit is a permit that's issued by DEQ, and to qualify for that, you have to go through many hoops. You have to have what's called an environmental management system that integrates your environmental program right into your whole management, so you don't have just an add-on environmental program that's wrapped up into the whole operation of the facility. Or you're doing something exceptionally good, like going well beyond minimal standards, you can get a green permit. There are probably about six of them issued in the state right now. Is a non-point source, which is a lot of agricultural operations or things like that, because one of the reasons that this was included when we negotiated this with the governor's office is the point sources have been regulated pervasively for years. We've got a good handle on that, and we're looking for a good, positive incentive way to get non-point sources into the process, and this is a good way to do that. Some of these would involve farming operations, so we'd have to find a farmer that admitted they made money, I guess. Yeah. Sorry. Recycling facility, energy recovery. If the credit is less than $200,000, you fall into the upper tier. If you're located in an enterprise zone or a distressed area, you also fall into that upper tier. So those are the types of things that get you in. The idea was to make it almost a checkoff. You know, check this off, you're in the upper tier.
And was your testimony then that under the bill, applications that fall under this top tier would still be governed by DEQ?
That would still be reviewed by DEQ. Okay.
Yes. Although it's interesting, as we talk about that, as you go through that list, 4H, the location within the enterprise zone, that really is strictly economic development. That really doesn't have an overt environmental aspect to that, yeah, other than simply where it's located.
Mr. Chair, that's true. I think some of these, even on the environmental side, you either have a green permit or you don't. So I think in that case, all they'd have to do is call up DEQ. This is a checkoff thing. You know, does this company have a green permit? That's going to be a yes or no. If it's more involved, for instance, do they have an environmental management system that would meet specifications? That would take some more review. But the design was to make this as simple as possible, as low overhead as possible.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Ledger, Senator Berger?
I'm unfamiliar with this, and clearly there were major changes very recently. And so can you give me a sense, if you would, of how the changes are working? Your graph talks about a different program, basically, in some sense.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, that's true. And as a matter of fact, part of the reason the economic impact was so low is because the new program really takes a while to kick in. But what the new program does, essentially, in many cases, is simply disappear. Especially on the lower tiers. It drops after 2003 and goes away after 2005. So there'd be companies that, if the old program were kind of allowed to run, simply would not have the incentive, especially if you're smaller. It just wouldn't be there for them. Last session's bill was a very, very prolonged negotiation. And I think now what we're doing is going back and saying, can we use this as an economic tool? And at the time we did those negotiations, that the issue of needing an economic tool was not as pressing, and it wasn't as high in the hierarchy of negotiations.
All right. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ledger, and this may be a question in general that I'd like people to address as they talk about this. And forgive me, the fact is I was here last session. I was not on any of the committees that dealt with this issue, and I have probably less knowledge of the issue than I should. I'm wondering, right now, that the way we structure these programs is as a tax credit with these criteria that we've just been discussing. I'm wondering if it would not make more sense from the standpoint of the state if we were to use it instead of as a tax credit, if we were actually to budget for an expenditure item to encourage economic development and the development of growth in jobs and target specifically toward businesses that we want to encourage to come to Oregon rather than what really amounts to a much broader, what appears to me at least, kind of a scattershot approach in a tax credit without the kind of controls that we could have with with an expenditure item instead. In other words, collect the money and then expend it in a targeted way. Do you have any thoughts about that issue as an alternative to a tax credit? And I would address that question generally to other people who want to talk about this kind of an issue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I think it kind of depends on how you view how the market should work. I think under the kind of operation that we're using now, what you're doing is you're essentially saying to corporations, if you're willing to provide high-wage jobs, because these are manufacturing jobs, and you can make some money and use the market, then we're here and we're open for business for you. And the whole process funding the credits, top to bottom, is financed by the company that wants to get the credit, top to bottom, completely.
The administration.
The administration. As opposed to, like, establishing some type of a board or commission and saying, we want this company or we want that company. I think over the years, I think something like we're looking at the tax credits, I think, would work better.
Okay.
Well, I have a follow-up then, if I may. And maybe I'm belaboring a point.
No, that's okay. That's all right.
Trust me,
the entrance to the tunnel of pollution control tax credit can be dark and foggy.
Well, if the chair's willing to admit that.
And once you get in, it only gets darker.
Well, maybe I don't ask my question.
Why at the end?
Mr. Ledger and others, if I understand the point you're making, and it's a reasonable one, it's a sensible one. I guess what I'm really thinking about too is the comparison between the costs of a state-administered program expending money in a targeted way versus the cost of paying for some pollution tax credits that we probably wouldn't pay for if we were doing it intentionally on that particular job. Because they meet the criteria specifically stated in the bill, but may not necessarily meet the criteria that we would devise if we were planning for expending state funds through the Ways and Means process. I guess what I'm thinking is that the Ways and Means process would probably result in expending fewer dollars overall, and I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about the cost of the administration that the state would incur in that kind of a program as compared to the more laissez-faire approach that this program allows for.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnard, I think there'd be a great number of people in the business community that would be very concerned about having a essentially state-sponsored selection of which corporations are welcome in the state. Also, one of the things that this program does is you only use the credit if you make money. That's it. So in a sense, it's self-regulating during a recession. Because right now, as you can see, the credits are probably dropping off the bottom of the chart right now because nobody's using the credits, nobody's making any money during a recession. So in a sense, the state isn't expending anything. But what the credit does is offer that in the future. So when it's saying if you come here and you make money, you know, 3, 4, 6 years from now, this is waiting for you as a promise that you can use. If you take the money in and then spend it out, you're doing an expenditure at that time. Right now, your expenditures on pollution control tax credits are probably next to nothing because it's a promise of something if you invest, as opposed to a payout now. So right now, the state would be paying out a lot more money, probably.
Well, that's the trade-off. In the direct expenditure, mm-hmm. you're paying for these pollution pollution control systems, whether or not they're the company or the businesses that's implementing them is making any money. Under this system, there is no upfront cost to the state. It's all derived from whatever income is earned. And the other thing I think is important too, maybe for committee members, the amount of the credit is applied not against the total cost of the project, but against a particular qualified pollution control component of that. So if you're talking about a paper mill, the credit isn't a percentage of the cost of the construction of the mill. It's the cost of whatever components in there would constitute the pollution control systems. I mean, is that about right?
That's correct.
Mr. Chair, could I pursue that just a minute? Because Mr. Ledger indicated that most of these tier one...
top tier?
No, the other tier.
Low tier,
go to smaller businesses. So how would that play out, for instance, indulge me a little because I'm trying to get on board in this tunnel you've described. In the case...
Tunnel of love.
Yeah. The case of the... service station fixing a tank. How would that play out?
It gets a little, Mr. Chairman, Representative.
Oh, it gets complicated.
Yes. I actually have a chart that I'm threatening to put up there with you, and Mark has seen it. Not want to see this because if you are under $200,000, then you automatically go into the top tier.
Under $200,000.
Right. So what we did was we put small operations that are really, you know, awards under 2,000 into the top tier. 200,000 into the top tier. So there's this. This is a very bizarre operation. I mean, let me put it that way. But what we tried to do was accommodate, people that come in with service station. Okay, we wanted them to get in the top tier because there wasn't that much difference in some cases between whether you're in a top or low to the program if you're looking at 35 and 50 or 25 and 35. So a lot of these are in fact for gas station removals if you look. And so if you came in and you had a gas station, you removed the tank and whatever part, you go to the DEQ and whatever part qualified, and I don't know what that would be, whatever part qualified, you would be in the top tier if you were under $200,000. Now, if you flipped over $200,000 and you didn't meet one of these other criteria, then you'd drop into the lower tier. And part of the theory was, if you're getting something over $200,000, you're probably getting into a larger, more sophisticated operation where you should get rewarded if you do the extra things or not if you don't.
Let's move on. It may get brighter as we go through. Kind of like transportation taxes, it takes a while to, or Shakespeare, it takes a while to kind of... to get your ear attuned to the language. Who wants to go next?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing the Oregon Metals Industry Council. As the chair, I think, painfully is aware, because he was very, very involved in the negotiations on this bill, I think dark and foggy is rather generous. it was quite a process, and quite honestly and directly, you had one major policy, in my mind, policy change that I think was very beneficial to the program, and that is the two-tier system to try to look at projects in terms of what percentage you were going to allocate based upon the two-tier approach and the certifications, which I think was not part of the pollution control tax credits in the past, and I think was a very, very good addition to this process. The other parts of the bill that we're here addressing today, the percentage reductions that were put into place, and the sunsets were really political kinds of decisions that were made, quite honestly. The program was set to sunset. The governor, let's say, was not over enthusiastic about the program, preferred to let it sunset. The business community and members of this body were very enthusiastic about this program, we believe it was a very valuable program over the years. So we were placed within a situation of trying to negotiate something that kept the program moving along, but tried to recognize some of the governor's concerns. And quite honestly, we're back here today to bring the program back to where it was. And that's what we want to do because we think it's extremely valuable. And so that's why you see the percentages going back up. But we're retaining what we believe is a very valuable asset of this program, which is the two-tier approach. Again, we find it very valuable. The movement to economic and community development is simply a recognition that this program is, in fact, an economic development stimulus program. That's what it's designed for. It's been in DEQ all of this time, but that doesn't change how this program is viewed and used by industry over the years. It is, in fact, and I think DEQ would agree, this has not been their favorite poster child over the last 20 years. It has been, at times, a program that they wanted to get rid of and, in fact, introduced legislation to do that. Now, the Department administration has changed, and they are more receptive to this program, and we recognize that. At the same time, it doesn't change what this program is, and we believe it's an economic stimulus tool, and it really belongs in economic development. To the degree that there are sign-offs or there is some work that needs to be done on the certifications, that still is retained within DEQ, and that's an important factor. But I don't want to paint a picture that we have two administrations going on here. This will be administered by economic and community development. To the point for the sign-offs, yes, that will occur at DEQ, but the program is in fact being moved to economic and community development, and we believe that's the proper way. So we're back here today to bring this program to where we believe it belongs and where it's has been exceptionally effective in attracting business and exceptionally effective in causing environmental cleanup controls for industry throughout the state and for the benefit of all Oregonians. So we think it works both ways, economically and environmentally. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Mark, I just want to, going back to something we talked about earlier, I'm looking at Section 6. This is on page 5. This is sort of where the role between economic development and DEQ is outlined. It says that if economic development believes the applicant is described in 468-173-4A, that would be the ISO, or if the facility is for B to G, then they forward it to DEQ.
That's correct.
B to G doesn't include the enterprise zone qualification. So we talked about that earlier. Those would not go to DEQ. If you're enterprise zone, that remains just an economic development determination. I'm wondering, just in looking at this, whether also whether we would want to exempt out of the $200,000 category, because, again, that doesn't really seem to have any environmental judgment attached to it. That's just a dollar amount. Something to consider anyway. If we might want to consider exempting that out from the DEQ certification if we go this direction.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Okay.
We can look at that.
Doug Riggs. I'm sorry.
Just to follow up on that, I'm missing a piece here. I suspect that the chair knows the answer to it, but and the people here do, but I don't. How do we figure out whether something's a pollution device? If it's one of these things that is happening in one of the areas where it doesn't go to DEQ for certification, how do we know?
Okay, so you get an application and it says it's under $200,000,
or it's in a
yeah, well, sure,
or it's in an economic enterprise zone. Without the certification from DEQ, how do we know it's a pollution device?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, in the rules, the applicant is required to actually have an audited submission where they will actually hire some company, whoever does this kind of things, and they will audit the application to make that determination. And then if there's any question, then it could certainly go DEQ from there. Historically, what is done, too, is the applicant will hire an auditor to certify, and the rules, I'm hesitant to bring this up, but there are enormous rules to make this bill look clean. And if you go through those rules, now we have lawyers that make a lot of money off of this. You go through the rules, and it specifies out what is and what isn't. You get that certified, goes over to the agency. Very often the agency will send it out to be certified again by another party, paid for by the applicant. So it goes through a lot of hoops. But also, when you look at these things, you look at a list of what's sent. It's very nuts and bolts. It's grates. It's cyclone collectors. It's particulate capture bins. It's transformers for electrostatic precipitators. It's pits. I mean, you look at it. It's pretty clear.
Not to us, but
yeah. So what they are is
okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good. Mr. Chairman, good morning, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Riggs. I'm here with PacWest Communications on behalf of Golden Northwest Aluminum, with operations both in the Dalles, Oregon, and Goldendale, Washington. My job today is to kind of give you a real-world example of a company that's on the ground, struggling to survive these difficult economic times, and which definitely will be impacted by this bill. We strongly support the bill and its provisions, and I think Mark and John went into some good detail about what the bill actually does. Let me give you a little bit of background about why we care about this and why it's so important to us. Since 1986 and until the last couple of years, the company has been the largest employer in Wasco County. Obviously, the recent energy crisis and low worldwide aluminum prices have resulted in a severe curtailment of our operations. Until 2001, with plentiful and affordable electricity, the Northwest as a region provided 40% of all aluminum produced in the country and 8% of the worldwide aluminum capacity, which is pretty amazing given the Korean and Chinese and Russian dumping of aluminum. Unfortunately, as you all know, electricity has gone up in price, skyrocketed. And so this simple fact places Golden Northwest Aluminum at a severe economic disadvantage with both our U.S. and global competitors. So our view is that to balance the economic playing field, Oregon must retain and strengthen the remaining economic incentives that we have for manufacturing businesses, such as those contained in House Bill 2652. For us to remain viable on the worldwide aluminum market, we are going to have to spend significantly on capital improvements to modernize our operating facilities. The company has identified more than $3 million in environmental improvements that are not required by U.S. EPA, Oregon DEQ, or other agencies at our smelters in the Dalles. These improvements would significantly reduce air emissions, wastewater effluent, and the release of solid waste and hazardous waste for the environment. We're also trying to pilot a new aluminum manufacturing technology that, if successful, would revolutionize the method of making primary aluminum in this region. The new technology, again, would significantly reduce air emissions and waste generation compared to our existing manufacturing technology. And we believe that the technology could be commercially viable within 5 years, which I would note is not within the stratus of the current statute we have. It is worth noting that Goldendale Northwest Aluminum has not applied for the pollution control tax credit since 1986. And the reason is that we have spent money on these projects but did not believe that the Oregon Environmental Quality Commission, or the DEQ, had a strong enough level of support for the projects that we were pursuing. We were also concerned about the 10-year schedule issue. And whereas this bill would transfer to the Department of Economic Community Development, we believe that the DEQ's primary mission has been for environmental purposes and not really to focus on economic development. Fundamentally believe that strong economics and environmental performance are consistent goals. Production inefficiency leads to waste and lost economic opportunity. We believe that OECDD should assume the lead role in this tax credit program and approving the tax credits, and believe that the bill includes adequate provisions to ensure proper DEQ oversight as applicable. I will note that we believe that if Oregon is to maintain any manufacturing whatsoever, we need to change our perspective on these types of projects, and we think the bill is a step in that direction. I did want to note, in response to Representative Barnhart's question, I think there are two things that we need to consider here. The first would be our concern that if you set up any sort of a government screening committee, who would be on that committee, and would they be able to identify what the industries of the future are going to be? You know, if you look 25 years ago, for instance, in the Washington County area at high tech, would a government panel or a task force have been able to identify high tech as the significant employer that it is today? Maybe they would have, maybe they wouldn't have. But we, I think, would be concerned about limiting the application of the tax credit system only to those companies identified or those industries identified by a set of government experts. And the second point that I wanted to make is that I think part of the goal of this tax credit program is to provide a wide incentive or economic advantage to companies to actually invest in environmental and pollution control. And so from my perspective, the wider the better from the environmental perspective. The more companies and the wider variety of industries that we can get to adopt these kind of technologies, the better off not only the companies will be, but also the environment. So in closing, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. We strongly support the bill and look forward to working with the committee to ensure its passage.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Hess?
Thank you. To all of you, I guess. I've been a supporter of this program in the past, and I guess my question is, where does this rank in terms of tax breaks for economic development in the big picture? Most of you have come before seeking other tax breaks from research and development, capital gains in the name of economic development, and the state cannot afford to do all of these. And so I'm just wondering where this is. Is this the best thing that can happen? And you have concrete examples of how this is bringing new business and attracting and keeping business here and creating jobs. Frankly, I did not see this on business recommendations or in the summit that we had last fall as one of the top things that Oregon should do to turn this economy around. And so I'm just wondering where this ranks in comparison to the other tax breaks that have been requested for business.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hess, I think one of the reasons you didn't see it on the list is because it is an existing program, although it, in our mind, has been watered down tremendously, and that's why we're here today. Maybe a more general kind of answer, and from my perspective in looking at the last year and a quarter of special sessions, we spent 1 week on economic stimulus before the beginning of this session. That was a week in December of 2001 following the second downturn in revenue forecast. We've had a lot of discussion about new taxes, a lot of pain in cuts that we've all gone through, and we've been on both sides of that discussion. But we've had virtually no discussion in terms of how do we stimulate the economy. There are all kinds of proposals out there for new taxes, broad tax reform. Many of you know we've run a lot of ballot measures in this state, ballot measure property tax limitations and a sales tax, which we had our head handed to us. I believe that it's very, very difficult to push forward tax reform. I want to support that, but I think it's very difficult. And where I think we have to put our attention is on economic development and the one engine that we have, which is income tax. And we've done very little up to this point, although now I think we're coalescing a lot of different pieces of legislation to do this. This is just one small piece of that. You say there are many, many proposals in here. Many of them, I think, do interconnect and do work to stimulate the economy and to stimulate this income tax program, which we have to live by at this point to generate dollars. So I don't see this as a silver bullet. It is just one bullet in an arsenal of, you know, I saw a list the other day that the Growth Committee or the Growth Caucus has put together of about 20 different pieces of legislation. Excellent pieces of legislation. I think many of them put together will have a real impact on the economy.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, Mr. Chairman, Representative Haas, this is certainly not the only thing that a company like Golden Northwest Aluminum would be concerned about, but it's one very important piece of the puzzle. And especially when you have a company that is a manufacturing company that is trying to modernize and considering, you know, the worldwide price of aluminum and electricity prices, it would be very easy for a company to move offshore. So for a company that wants to stay in Oregon, wants to stay in the Northwest, this is one very key component of the opportunity. I mean, a $3 million economic expenditure for one of the two plants is fairly significant. And so incentives that will not only help the economy, but I believe also help the environment, are very important. Is it the only thing that will help or the most important thing? Maybe not, but it's one of those factors that companies consider as they decide whether or not to stay here or expand.
Mr. Chair, if I
yes, could sure, you
follow
may.
Up. I mean, those are legitimate responses, and we've talked about this before, that these are all very important. Economic development is maybe one of the most important things we could do here, but whatever we do in the realm of economic development strategy in this session, it pales in comparison to an economic development disaster we have now when you chop a month of school year off of Portland school year, for example. I noticed Doonesbury wasn't making jokes about our pollution tax credit phase out. And the more that we try to pay for these tax breaks, the more difficult it is for us to also send a strong message, I think, in an economic development strategy that Oregon has good schools and a strong quality of life. And so it's going the other direction. And we need to sort of get to a balance where we can do both. And perhaps it's chicken and egg. I don't think so. But if it is chicken and egg, maybe it's if we develop a strong higher ed and K-12 program and get back to a quality of life that once made this state famous for its quality of life, then economic development will be achieved in a much easier way.
If I could comment on that briefly, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hass, there has been a huge loss of industrial jobs in this state, of high-paying jobs, good union jobs that pay a lot. And it's been awful. I mean, when I talk to some of these companies, our members that have laid off 3,000 people, high-paying jobs. And those people are not paying taxes that support the schools anymore. And if we want them to pay taxes to support the schools, they have to work at high-paying jobs, manufacturing jobs. I mean, that's where the money comes from. It comes from manufacturing jobs, in fact, ultimately. And Oregon, we used to be able to attract them because we had really low power rates, and it was easy. And those days are gone. And the Northwest, Oregon included, is not viewed as business-friendly, as you know, rightly or wrongly, by the rest of the country. And I think by letting something like a program like this slip, that doesn't have, we're looking at, what, $300,000, whatever, that doesn't have a huge expenditure to it, the signal it sends to the rest of the country is, if you're thinking about doing something that does high-paying jobs, good jobs, Oregon's, the signal is Oregon's not interested. And I don't think that's how we get those jobs here that pay good union wages, high wages, that support the schools. We have to get people working at good wages to get money into the schools. And it's a, and I guess it maybe it's chicken and egg, you know, or a spiral down, but you know, we won't get there by continuing to lose our manufacturing base, and that's what this is. These are the credits people are turning in, and it's going down because there aren't as many people turning them in, and they're not making any money. The manufacturers aren't there, or it wouldn't be going down. We need to turn that line around.
I think it is a balance and probably a balancing issue that, well, we talked about it on Tuesday, and we'll deal with it as we go. And I agree. I don't think it's a chicken and egg thing. Somehow we've got to bring the chicken along with the egg because they've got to be there together. If we just have an egg and there's no chicken to sit on it, it's never going to hatch. And so that's the balancing we've got to do, is somehow bring these both. We've got to find a chicken with an egg and then just get it through the door.
And I apologize. I didn't mean to be strident.
No, I understand. We're going to struggle with this, and you'll hear this discussion, I'll bet, here more than once on the balance between stimulus and the need to maintain programs at hand, including education in particular. But Doug, do you want to, we need to move on.
I just wanted to point out, I think John makes an excellent point. There are 800 to 1,000 steel workers in the Dalles and Wasco County who are currently unemployed. All of them would be paying taxes if we could get operations started up. And again, Representative Haas, Mr. Chairman, this is not the only factor. Obviously, power prices are a significant factor. But this would be one small factor that might allow that company to start back up again.
Okay, let's move on. We've got a couple more witnesses here, then we've got a couple other bills I want to make sure we get to. And although I'm not surprised this one is taking us a little extra time because it's probably the most obscure and obtuse of the bills we'll be talking about here. So I'm happy to take some time to get our hands around it. Gene Wilkinson, you're signed up. Let's bring you up. And Matt Blevins, you're on deck. And that's all I have on this bill. Go ahead, Jean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jean Underhill Wilkinson. I'm an Associate Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. I'll make my testimony very brief. Senator Dave Nelson sponsored the Dash 1 amendments, which are very short, just provide a small clarification to the bill. He did that on Farm Bureau's request. Some people may wonder, just briefly here, what the relationship is between agriculture and pollution control and what agriculture does. We are undergoing a massive change in researching and applying new technologies in the agriculture and ranching communities for pollution control. A couple of examples of these are no-till, or otherwise called direct seed farming. That is a situation where you apply new machinery and new management systems in order to stop the traditional plowing, which can have effects on water quality from runoff, and instead you directly seed into your last year's crop, your last year's stubble. A new type of management system that is having, to those farmers who can afford to apply it, it's having tremendous beneficial effects. Also, in the ranching community, grazing rotation systems, where you take your large pastures and split them into small pastures, provide off-stream watering for those pastures and rotate those cattle around to give the property rest periods. That is also something that is, for those ranchers who can afford to implement those practices, are having tremendous beneficial effects. All of these technologies have been researched, and the steps are chosen to properly and effectively implement these types of conservation practices by a federal agency called the Natural Resource Conservation Service. It's a federal agency under the United States Department of Agriculture. They have gone through 25 years worth of research and study on how to properly apply conservation practices, and they have them all compiled in volumes called the Technical Field Guides, and those are applied nationwide, and then they're made specific to each watershed around the country. And NRCS has field offices and field men that help the farmers and ranchers apply these technologies with the cooperation of soil and water conservation districts and watershed councils. It's a wonderful system that is really taking off in this state. So that the small amendment or clarification is to clarify that what we're talking about 9 times out of 10 with agriculture and non-point source pollution control are those practices and land management systems that are approved and recommended by the federal agency, Natural Resource Conservation Service. So it really gives some certainty to the public and some credibility to these agriculture practices that they're being done under a unified system that's approved by the federal government. Thank you.
Questions? I have one. Gene, the bill addresses, at least as it stands right now, the credit is directed at facilities, which I think would probably have pretty identifiable costs attached. Do you have a sense how, a management system, how do you attach a cost to that for the purpose of claiming a credit? Do you have a sense of how that
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that can be done. What normally happens now is if a farmer thinks that he or she has a pollution issue that needs to be taken care of, they go directly to the Soil and Water Conservation District and the NRCS field office to have those people evaluate what the problem is and what system should be applied. And then the NRCS provides the technical assistance and the engineering for the farmer to apply those that system. And along with that is a cost estimate of what it would cost. So that's it's worked out in detail with the federal agency along with SWCDs to figure out what those costs are. So those could be easily identified.
Other questions?
Representative Chair, this may not be exactly on topic, and if it's not, say so. But I'm wondering if the new biodigesters that are starting to be used in feedlots and things of that sort would fit into the areas that we're talking about, and whether those would be a subject to the credit.
Mr. Feedlot. Chair, Representative Barnhart.
Oh, sorry. Would feedlot come under a CAFO designation?
Representative Representative Barnhart, a feedlot would come under the CAFO designation. Now, those biodigesters, I don't know a lot about those, but I don't think that those would be considered necessarily non-point source pollution control and fit into that category. It might fit into the category under the industrial type of pollution control facilities.
But it does fit under the bill.
Well, to the extent that non-point source pollution is defined in the bill to include a confined animal feeding operation, I'm guessing that the coverage there.
I would have to do a little bit of studying to see if those biodigesters would fit under the bill.
Well, I raise that issue, Mr. Chair, because this is one of those places where the new technology is really making huge strides in reducing pollution that otherwise flows into the air and into the water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Matt Blevins and Patrick Keene.
Chair Chitterly, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, my name is Matt Levins. I'm the Legislative Affairs Director with the Oregon Environmental Council. Thanks for this opportunity to testify today. Obviously, the Oregon Environmental Council is not opposed to tax credits that help to promote good environmental preservation and stewardship of our natural resources here in Oregon. But that said, we oppose House Bill 2652, which would expand the pollution control tax credit. Among other things, this bill would eliminate Section 6-10, allowing activities that are not above and beyond what is required by law to be subsidized with taxpayer money. In addition, the bill undercuts the agreement struck last session that reduced the credit to 25% in 2001-03 and 15% in 2003-05, and then phasing that out and replacing that with a credit that goes above and beyond. This would also change the percentage to 40% and eliminate the sunset date of December 2005. It also increases the credit for work that goes above and beyond from 35% to 50%, which we, again, think is problematic. I wanted to just add to the fog that folks were referring to earlier about, again, what we're talking about here in terms of the cost to of the program to the state. If you look at our wonderful tax expenditure report, which I'm sure all of you have handy, you'll see, again, that the 2001-03 revenue impact for this program was $28.2 million in the 2001-03 biennium, and it's projected to be $22.8 million in the 2003-05 biennium. That, again, if you look at the revenue fiscal statement that you got, just want to remind you that the fiscal statement you're getting is on top of those millions and millions of dollars that people are already claiming under this. So this is not an insignificant program in terms of the impact, obviously, that it has on state coffers, and we think people should definitely remember that. I think that, you know, it's fairly clear from the previous testimony that the amendments here are not sort of the full intent. The ideal would be to get back to what we had before the changes that were enacted last session to this program. And I think that the committee needs to be clear what that means. Again, to talk about this program as a means of economic development and a way to help small businesses to comply with pollution control isn't really truthful. The reality is that 75% of the money that's been claimed under this program in its history has gone to cover costs that otherwise were required by law. It has not gone to provide for things that would go above and beyond the current law for the most part. It also has not gone, the bulk of the money has not gone to smaller businesses. In fact, it's gone to large businesses, and I don't have the specific number in front of me, but it's a pretty gross majority of the overall tax credit has gone to a very small number of large corporations here in Oregon. So as an economic development tool, there seems to be a lot better efforts that we can pursue. You can read the evaluation of the pollution control tax credit in the tax expenditure booklet here, and the evaluation is pretty clear. It says the expenditure has been only partially successful in achieving its purpose as an incentive to promote the installation of some pollution control equipment that otherwise would not have been installed. Only 25% of all tax credits approved since 1995 for this type of facility. Most expenditures provided a reward to taxpayers for activities that they are required to do anyway. 75% of approved tax credits were for principal purpose facilities. This tax expenditure would be far more effective if it were only allowed for investment in pollution control that would not otherwise be made. So there's a pretty clear message, I think, from our department about where that is. I think the other points I'd like to make are that, one, the pollution control tax credit has encouraged pollution control instead of pollution prevention. The tax credits encourage companies to buy expensive control equipment rather than change their manufacturing processes to prevent pollution in the first place. This encourages inefficient, short-term end-of-pipe solutions. Most states, like Oregon, implemented this kind of tax incentive program in the late 1960s and early 1970s to help companies retrofit their aging plants to meet new air and water pollution laws. Over time, as firms have built the new rules into their cost of doing business, nearly all states have phased out or cut back their programs. And again, previous testimony has talked about the need for this program to encourage jobs here in the state. And I think that, you know, the reality is if you look at other states, and for the record, under the program that we had up until last session, no state had as extensive as of a pollution control tax credit as we have here in Oregon. And if in fact this was such a good economic development tool, you would expect to see hordes of companies coming to the state to take advantage of this tax credit. And I don't think you saw that as other states phased out their tax credit in the past. So I think that we should definitely take that kind of testimony with a grain of salt. The other thing is that the pollution control tax credit is not an effective economic development tool. The credit is structured to encourage the purpose of the purchase of equipment and not the hiring of people. Companies can't get the credit for hiring an engineer to help change to a cleaner process or to cover the transition to a more labor-intensive process that will ultimately be cleaner and more cost-effective. Companies can't get the credit for the purchase of less toxic inputs so they don't need pollution control equipment. Companies can only receive the credit for the scrubber or other pollution control device that goes on the end of the pipe. The purchase of a $10 million scrubber doesn't create jobs in Oregon. In addition, a chief use of the credit in recent years has been to help finance pollution control capital expenditures and new plant construction. The credit is not large enough to entice companies to build plants in Oregon. Oregon's other economic development tax credits for enterprise zones or super enterprise zones or the strategic investment program are much more effective economic development tools. So if the state wants to modify the pollution control tax credit, and it should definitely look at narrowly targeting small businesses and non-point sources. I think we agree with the previous testimony from the Farm Bureau that this could be used to help reduce non-point pollution. That's one of the biggest pollution threats we have here in the state. But in fact, you know, CAFO or the confined area feeding operations are not those type of non-point source pollution problems so that we're looking at. There should be limitations on the total program spending and a cap on how much individual facilities can receive and an explicit connection to the facility's compliance record. Only those companies in compliance with Oregon's law should be allowed to apply for the credit. The state just adjusted the pollution control tax credit last session, as everyone knows, and those changes were implemented last session to phase out the current pollution control tax credit and replace it with incentives to go above and beyond the requirements of the law, which were a step in the right direction. At a minimum, we should allow those changes to be implemented, and any changes expansions to the pollution control tax credit or elimination of the sunset date is unwise, particularly given the state's fiscal crisis. We definitely encourage the committee to go slow on this issue and to really think this through, because we think that this is these amendments in this bill are headed in the wrong direction. With that, I'll take any questions. Thanks.
Questions? Representative Bridger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Matt, you didn't comment on the transfer to OECDD. Would you comment on that?
Yeah. Yeah, I think, again, we would oppose that. Again, I think it's sort of funny how this whole tax credit is talked about depending on the time and the day. You know, it sometimes it's talked about an economic development tool. Sometimes it's talked about one of the leading pollution prevention tools that we have. I think, again, we would support the DEQ's position on this, which is there's expertise needed to analyze and evaluate the pollution end of this, and that's where the credit comes from. And so it should be housed in the DEQ at this point. Moving it to an economic development program outright just doesn't seem to make any sense. If we want to do better economic development types of tax credits, well, let's talk about that separately from this program.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative
Mr. Blevins, it sounds as though you're suggesting that this credit may actually impede the corporations from using improved methods of manufacture, which would naturally result in lower pollution outputs than the methods that are in use now. Could you expand on that just a little bit?
Well, I think that it's not so much that it impedes. I think that we would make the case that there are much better and more effective ways to do that. You could, again, the trend of requiring companies to use this credit only when they're going above and beyond current practices seems to be the right trend. That's what we want to see more of happening. The changes that happened last session head in that direction, not necessarily as quickly or as effectively as we would like to see, but I think that's the kind of trend we could do. I mean, there's a number of other types of tax credits that we could expound on that could do this more effectively in our view, and we think this is probably the most ineffective and inefficient way to do and encourage that kind of behavior.
All right, anything else? Man, I'm going to guess that the revenue impact that's reflected in the tax expenditure report is probably overstated in light of what has continued to happen through this 0103 biennium to income, business and corporate income. I imagine the revenue impact is going to be substantially less than what was projected there. And then also, I'm guessing that the evaluation doesn't take into account yet the impact of the two-tier approach that went into effect last session in terms of its criticism there of not creating incentive to go above and beyond. I think that's sort of the purpose of having gone to that two-tier system. So the jury, I would guess, at least is still out there, but I think we've moved in that direction of creating that kind of incentive to go above and beyond.
And Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, I would not disagree with you at all. I think that partly makes the case for why any kind of changes to this program at this point are premature, because we really don't have any good analysis of whether or not the changes that we enacted last session are helping to move us in the right direction. And so trying to move us backwards, back to what we had before, seems to me, based on the data that we have previously, is the wrong way to go. And that's partly why I was highlighting that.
Moving on. Patrick Green.
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Patrick Green. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO and the Oregon Revenue Coalition. And I know we have a lot to do, so I won't go on too long. And I agree. And I'd just like to echo everything that Matt Blevins said from the Oregon Environmental Council. I would echo the fact that the jury's still out. There were changes made last session. We should let those changes roll out. We don't think that this should go into the Economic and Community Development Department. I think it's a good way to cloak a tax credit. Again, like Matt said, that's sometimes environmental, sometimes it's economic development, just like light is sometimes a wave and sometimes a particle. But the other thing is,
Dan Shakespeare was.
Yeah.
Just
wait, the trigonometry comes in my capital gains tax cut testimony. I'd just like to ask, where is the stimulus in this, and where are the jobs? Nothing I heard except for promises of jobs said that there would be jobs that came from this. I'm very sympathetic to the panel when they talked about high wage aluminum jobs. Those are union jobs, and those folks are out of work. There are steel workers out of work. There are members, and we care about them. But they're also they're also paying more taxes than the corporations that aren't making any money. They're paying more taxes on their unemployment benefits than the corporate minimum tax of $10. And so that's right when the panel said that they're not paying taxes anyway, because you only use the credit if you make money. Well, a number of these companies aren't making money, and they're not paying taxes. So there is a huge loss of industrial jobs. The panel said that we're not talking about economic stimulus this session, and I would maintain that talking about this tax expenditure continues the trend of not talking about economic stimulus because we don't believe that's what this is. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Green, Mr. Blevins. With that, I want to close the public hearing on House Bill 2652. Thank you, everybody, for your patience in bearing with us as we educate ourselves on this issue. And let me go on to something we're probably a little bit more conversant with, and that would be House Bill 2505. Open a public hearing on that. Lizbeth, you want to give us the background while I call up Joe Schweinhardt, Alan Thayer, and Charles Solving. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, with House Bill 2505, this is the capital gains cut bill, and basically you have it listed there of the phase-in of the cut according to going from 9% down to 8.5% in 2004, 7.5% in 2005, basically going down one percentage point until we hit 5% in 2008 and after. And with the corporate income tax rate, that is, will also be reduced to 5% on capital gains beginning in 2008, same year as the personal income tax is reduced. And just to make sure everyone's clear, too, you know, we still have the 579 structure in this income of capital gains. I know a lot of people just talk about it as it's just one rate, but you do still have that 579 structure embedded into capital gains income, even though you're just changing that top rate from 9% down to 5%. And you have in your packet there, just we might not have time today, but we basically have gone through and captured some of the dynamic effects to some of these proposals.
If we have time, we'll come back to that at the end. Otherwise, we may have to revisit that.
That's fine.
After.
We can
I
do
make
that
sure we get the testimony in today. We have done some. OTIM has chewed on these proposals and has rendered a verdict on various aspects of the stimulus effect, and we'll talk about those, but if we can keep those until we're done with these hearings so we get the testimony in today, then we'll talk about the dynamic impacts. Mr. Schweinhardt.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Schweinhardt with Associated Oregon Industries. Have with me today Alan Thayer and Cheryl Suave, who will be here today, and I would like to have them talk, give their testimony first, and I will give mine. We're here in obviously support of this bill. We think it's time that we start to look at reducing capital gains and making Oregon more business friendly. Alan, Charles?
Me first.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Charles Silvey. I live in Portland. I was a founding member of the Western Tax Association, made up primarily of academic and public members. The concern was with tax theory and its application. I was economist and research director for Oregon's Department of Economic Development. It was called Planning and Development then. I am a member of the National Association for Business Economics, whose members are encouraged to contribute to discussions on policy issues affecting the economy. As a citizen, I believe that capital gains should be taxed at a lower rate than ordinary income. A capital gain is realized when a capital asset is sold for more than it cost. In the case of a long-term capital gain, part, if not all, is due to inflation, that is, a decline in the value of the dollar. In some cases, the capital gains are in current, not real dollars, that is, they are phantom gains. There's a distinction between tax yields and tax rates. When the tax rate on capital gains is lowered, capital assets will be sold more often. Not every asset, of course, but economics operates on margins. The tax base, that is, the dollar amount of capital assets sold, would increase with lower rates, and this multiplied by the tax rate equals the yield. Regardless of whether the savings from reduced capital gains rate would go to business or individuals, the Oregon economy would benefit. Business would invest it or add to payrolls, increasing efficiency and output, and not incidentally the income tax base. A more favorable treatment of capital gains of individuals would increase consumption, investment, and savings. Although people with high incomes would benefit from lower tax rates on capital gains, many more with low to middle incomes would benefit. They now own more capital assets than formerly, either directly or through intermediates such as pensions and mutual funds. And people in anticipation of large capital gains can and do move outside of the state to states that do not tax capital gains. Thus, okay. Oregon loses the income tax they would pay were they to remain in this state. And they frequently start up enterprises in their new state. Low-income seniors often sell capital assets to meet living expenses. Sometimes they do not sell them based on economics because capital gains are not levied on assets going into estates. And finally, a tax should not discourage sound economic decisions.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, just one.
Yeah.
Thank you. Are pension the transactions within a pension account generally taxed capital gains taxes?
Well, if they're held for a long period of time, yeah.
If I may follow up, I understood that the pension accounts, by their nature, are not taxed until the money's withdrawn.
Well, that's right.
And then it's taxed at ordinary rates, regardless of the source of the money. Am I incorrect in that?
Well, it depends on what kind of the pensions there are.
I see. Thank you.
You can have a small business might have something different than a large one.
I see. Thank you very much.
Other questions?
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Alan Thayer. I'm a product of Oregon Public Schools and the Oregon higher education system. I'm a practicing business attorney in Eugene. For almost 18 years now, I have represented Oregon businesses, large and small. Today, I appear before you as a taxpayer, a professional that works with Oregon employers, and a member of Associated Oregon Industries. Oregon has a problem, a big problem. As our economy declines and household incomes fall, tax revenue available for the state also declines. Maybe that is not entirely bad, however, that government shares in the pain of its citizens. Mr. Chairman, as you know, the focus of this legislature should be on jobs, jobs, and jobs. Without employers, there are no employees. Therefore, if we want jobs for our citizens, tax revenue for our government, it is vital that we retain the employers that are currently located in the state, attract new employers to Oregon, and grow our economy so that existing Oregon employers hire more Oregon employees. There are pluses and minuses to doing business in Oregon. That is true of anywhere. You can help our economy, you can help create jobs, and you can help increase tax revenue by increasing the positives and decreasing our negatives. One of those negatives is Oregon's capital gains tax, the second highest capital gains tax in the country. That is why passage of House Bill 2505 is critical. By passing this bill, you can reduce one of our state's negatives and make Oregon a better place for business. Other states understand the need to enhance the advantages and disadvantages of doing business in their states. Over the past 10 years, they have sought to profit by lowering their taxes, and as a result, they've attracted new business. Have their profits been at our expense? Businesses notice and take action based on state policies. For example, I know of several mail order and internet retailers that are located in Oregon because we have no sales tax. The jobs they provide for order takers are very much appreciated. We must ask, however, where are their warehouses? Where is their payroll for warehouse and shipping workers? Where are their capital investments in buildings, equipment, and inventory? The inventories are not in Oregon. In many instances, they are in Nevada. Taxes on inventories are far less in Nevada than they are in Oregon. This is just one example of Oregon employers making location decisions based upon competing state policies. There's another business in Oregon that is posed to do absolutely fabulous things. The owner loves this state. However, people outside of Oregon have taken notice of their bright future. This business was offered 10 years of no county or city taxes and a $2 million no-interest loan with deferred payments to build a plant in another state. Will the business move? I don't know. Businesses have to compete or they die. If it is more expensive to do business in Oregon, what would you do? Our competition for employers is just not other states. The business I just mentioned has also been offered opportunities to manufacture in Asia where labor costs would be cut by 90%. Just recently, Kuwait offered to build a $16 million plant offshore for this company. Oregon is not in competition with other states. Oregon is in competition with other states and other countries. Not only do we compete to sell the goods manufactured and services performed by our citizens, but we compete when employers decide where to expand in good times and where to close facilities during difficult times. The tax on capital gain is one of the factors considered. If we lower our capital gains taxes, we reduce one of our disadvantages. We encourage the movement of new capital to Oregon, and we discourage the movement of existing capital out of the state. If we leave the tax at the current rate, we continue to discourage the investment of new capital in our state and encourage the flow of capital out of Oregon. With the movement of capital goes the movement of jobs, payrolls, and tax revenues. Retaining Oregon employers and attracting new capital investments are just two of the reasons for passing House Bill 2505. The third is stimulating economic growth. The employers I represent and employers all across this country are reacting to the current economic uncertainty by freezing hiring and making their businesses as productive as possible. The moderate growth we have seen has come through gains in productivity as a result of layoffs and better utilization of existing resources. We need to encourage Oregon businesses to increase their capital investments, increases that will lead to expansion of job creation. Making Oregon a more attractive place for capital can be key to strong and sustained economic growth. According to the National Venture Capital Association, between 1995 and 2001, venture capitalists financed an average of 1,700 businesses a year. A year later, in 2002, only 706 companies, 1,000 fewer, received initial rounds of venture financing. The National Venture Capital Association estimates that today more than $85 billion in venture capital is sitting on the sidelines waiting for investment opportunities. Let's make Oregon a more attractive place for some of that capital and encourage bold new business ventures, businesses that will increase their workforces and provide more Oregonians with opportunities to obtain stable employment and provide for their families. Lowering the capital gains tax rate in Oregon will increase the value of assets located in Oregon. This is what will attract capital to our state, capital that will produce Oregon jobs, expand the Oregon economy, and increase Oregon tax revenue. If this legislature is to adopt meaningful policies focused on jobs, jobs, and jobs, then cutting the capital gains tax through House Bill 2505 should be one of your top priorities. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Barnhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've mentioned here some tax theory, and you've mentioned some anecdotal cases to support your proposition. Have there been any scientifically based valid studies that would demonstrate that would support the propositions that you're making that would help us as we look at the potential losses of a third of $1 billion a couple of bienniums from now in our tax structure to justify this kind of a change?
Scientific studies, no. I believe Mr. Swainhart will be referring you to an article in the Wall Street Journal where they compared states and states that have aggressively cut their taxes on business and the success those states have had. When they compared the 50 states, they found that the top 10 states in terms of cutting taxes on businesses had tax revenue 20% higher, 27% higher than the country as a whole on an average. Where did Oregon rank in the 50 states? Absolutely dead last. I recently, in June, had an opportunity to sit on a presentation by the state of New York trying to lure businesses from Oregon and the rest of the country to do business in New York. I've got to tell you, they make a very compelling case as they talk about the 157 taxes that they have reduced in their state, eliminated or reduced. They make a compelling case. Oregon isn't even on the field. I mean, I got to tell you, when I left that presentation, I found it hard pressed to advise my clients on why they should continue to do business in Oregon. Now there's a lot of differences between the state of Oregon and the state of New York and the state of Georgia, where we want steel workers to lose their jobs, not here. But we've got to be in the playing field, and when we're dead last, we're not.
Mr. Chair, a follow-up on that, if I may. In the last, when talking about the last bill, Representative Haas asked a question about comparing these things. You've mentioned that you've used the term business taxes in response to my question. This particular tax might be a business tax. It's certainly a tax on investors. Can you place this proposal against the pollution tax credit proposal, which is a cut in business taxes, or some of the other proposals we're facing? And it's not just for you, but for the panel. And its importance. We're talking about a very large amount of money here. We don't have much money to spend. Where should we put it that will do the best job of encouraging the development of business? I have to tell you, I'm not convinced that this is it.
Well, what I would encourage you to do is, if you're trying to keep Oregon employers that are already here and keep them in business, keep them from moving their manufacturing offshore, you need to look at this from the perspective of a business executive, a business owner, instead of the perspective of a legislator. And that perspective is weighing the pluses and minuses of doing business in Oregon compared to the pluses and minuses of doing business in another state. And as you look at these tax packages, remember, we're not talking about tax expenditures. We're talking about investments that will pay dividends. Just look at the good years we had just a few years ago and the increase in tax revenue as a result of those good years. Right now, we're dead last in terms of a place to locate an Oregon business based upon taxes. And so as you try to decide where to prioritize between different sorts of tax expenditures, look at it from the perspective of business owners and what would induce them to locate here or continue to do business here rather than the state of Washington or the state of Kentucky.
One final, if I may.
All right. Yeah,
very, very short.
Get you through yet.
Could you give us the citation on the Wall Street Journal article you referred to?
Yes, we'll get to it.
Thank you.
Representative Farr.
Thank you. Very quickly, when we get to full rollout, we'll be at 5% on this. Where does that place us with other states?
I'll defer to Joe on that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Farr, it puts us very close to the middle.
Very close to the
middle. Which we, as a state can live with, because then it doesn't stick out like a sore thumb when you're trying to get somebody into the state to do business or to stay in business. We're in the mainstream then of what people are charging.
Thank you.
Carefully.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Huh? Joe, did you have something else?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Schweinhart, represent Associated Oregon Industries, and for the record, AOI is Oregon's largest and oldest business association in Oregon, represent over 22,000 businesses. Obviously, I'm here in support of House Bill 2505. This is the bill that will cut 0.5 point of the capital gains in 04, 1 point in successive years of 05, 06, 07, and another 0.5 point in 08. We think this is a way to ease the pain on the budget, at the same time provide a stimulus for the economy as the economy starts to grow. It's my understanding that a 0.5% cut in 04 right now would cost about $120,000 in revenues. The 05 amount would run to about $80 million, again, depending on what the economy does. Capital gains cuts will provide further capital for business growth and state tax revenues. Now is the time to cut capital gains. What House Bill 2505 does is allow for changes to take place, as I've said, as the economy grows, putting money in the hands of the consumer, as well as providing growth capital for business. According to a February 21, 2001 article in the Wall Street Journal titled, Do Tax Cuts Work? Just Look at the States, They examine the use of tax cuts by governors to stimulate their economy. And I quote the study. The governors are providing that tax cuts can be highly effective economic stimulant. Their research indicates that over the past decade, the 10 states that cut taxes the most created about twice as many new jobs, enjoyed about 27% more income growth than the 10 states that raised taxes. This study grades according to tax cuts restraining the growth of government. The two highest grades were Massachusetts and Nevada. The lowest, as you may have guessed, and it has been said, was Oregon. In the 2001 legislative session, the Department of Revenue, using the OTEM model on Senate Bill 67, which cut capital gains by 5%, predicted that such a cut would increase the number of jobs in the Oregon's economy by 4,500, and that the personal income would increase by $124 million. So it is out there. It can happen. Senator Farioli said it best in his statement in support of capital gains cuts on the Senate floor in 2001. He stated, and I quote again, "The high capital gains rate stifles investment, depresses personal income, makes retirement portfolios unstable, and holds down the value of Oregon's small business." Finally, I would like to comment on previous statements about capital gains. One has been said, will capital gains cuts have an economic impact? Yes, it will. But capital gains cuts is only one piece of the economic puzzle that needs changing. Besides what I have said previously, capital gains has an important impact. It will impact Oregon's economy by placing greater purchasing power to Oregonians as well as providing growth revenue. It will greatly slow the Oregon capital from moving out of state. We have a 9% capital gains rate, which is the second highest in the nation. Cutting it to 5% will make Oregon more attractive to business and increase incentives for successful businesses to stay in Oregon. By comparison, California tax is 9.3%, Idaho is 7.8%, Utah is 7%, and Washington and Nevada are zero. Remember, Oregon economists say this will be a jobless recovery, very little increase in income tax revenues. There was also another point made about, and I think was made again this morning in a previous meeting, that the statistic presented is 36,000 C corporations paid only the $10 registration fee, but no taxes. What was not said is that the vast majority of these corporations are defunct small businesses with no presence, and they do not have a nexus, and that many of these corporations simply didn't make any money. Another point to look at is capital gains go to the rich. In terms of income, according to the Department of Revenue chart that you have in front of you, using the 2002 figures, indicates that actual income levels of taxpayers adjusted gross income by the number of returns claiming a capital gain or a loss. It indicated that income levels, and I only summarize here with the 0 to 60,000 actually make up 54% of all returns. Studies on economic gains by economist William Connolly clearly indicated that capital assets are important to people over 65. According to Federal Reserve data, 59.5% of people between 55 and 64 own capital gains assets, whereas 46.5% of the people over 65 own capital gains assets. This is very important to our seniors. Many people rely on capital gains for their retirement. Two facts are important here, and I think have been alluded to earlier. First, people dispose of their assets by realizing capital gains as they enter retirement years. Second is simply that seniors still hold a good amount of the nation's assets. Capital gains tax is an undue burden on seniors who provide for their retirement years by saving and investing. To close, let me quote part of a study and a report by Dr. Roger Brenner of the Parthenon Consulting Group. His study, Oregon Revenue Prospects and Strategies, was reported to the Interim Committee's April 20, 2002 hearing before this committee. I'm sure, Mr. Chairman, you probably remember this report. He made three points. First, that consumer confidence is a very powerful source in our economy. Second, that profit and payroll taxes are the major disincentives in our economy. And third, very important here for the Oregon economy over the future years, if a state creates a materially adverse tax climate, current business will gradually migrate out of state, either by abruptly moving entire productions or administrative operations, or by locating all expansions in a more favorable location. Potential new business will find a better option. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the capital gains issue is not about giving businesses an incentive. It's about cutting disincentives and making Oregon business friendly in the future. Cut the capital gains tax is the first step. And I'd like, just for the record, to read out the following organizations in Oregon have signed on in support of House Bill 2505. Oregonians for Food and Shelter, Oregonians Association of Realtors, Oregon Farm Bureau, Oregon Metals Industry Council, the Northwest Food Processors Association, Oregon Restaurant Association, Oregon Auto Dealers Association, the Northwest Automotive Trades Association, Oregon Small Business Coalition, and the Oregon Forest Industries Council, to name most. Finally, Mr. Chairman, I want to urge you to support House Bill 2505. I think it's a way to decrease the burden of the capital gains tax, at the same time having the easiest effect on, obviously, a difficult task you have above in front of you with the budget. If I may take 1 minute, and for the record, the pollution control tax credits, the statement was made that even though we have a very favorable pollution control tax credit, that people were not coming to Oregon. I would venture to guess that even with that potential credit, which, while it would be great for Oregon to have an advantage, they're not coming here because they're still faced with the high capital gains, the high energy cost, and other disincentives that makes even the pollution control advantage not worth looking at. And with that, I'll be happy to take questions.
All right. With some trepidation, I ask, are there any questions? Joe, I remember Dr. Brenner's presentation, and part of what he said was that we were undershooting our economist was undershooting his recovery projection for the I remember that very well. Mr. Representative Barnhart.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. One simple one, I hope. Do you disagree with the revenue impact statement that we have here about what the revenue impact would be of this thing?
I have not seen the one that you have in front of you, obviously.
It's stated today.
Yeah. No, I've not seen it.
That's just been distributed to us, I guess.
Okay. Well, it shows a huge, even with a dynamic analysis, it still shows a huge reduction in tax revenues.
In fairness to them, since they haven't seen it, we'll come back to that. We'll have a discussion.
I would love to have a comment on that issue from this from AOI, because the reason I ask the question is because if your claims are all true, then a dynamic analysis of the tax structure, tax receipts, assuming it's a valid analysis, should show that our income will increase over time because of the increases in the economy resulting from this tax cut that you've posited. And this analysis doesn't show that at all.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, I understand what you're saying, and I have gotten some numbers from legislative revenue, and maybe we need to look at those and see what you
think. Thank you. I'd appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right.
Chairman, I was just going to say it's very difficult to determine at this time with all the problems we've got, international and whatnot, but even without that, you'd have to make some rather heroic assumptions about the causal variables. There's many variables, and it's a very subjective thing in determining what the impact would be.
Well, and Mr. Chair, that's precisely the point I'm trying to make as we analyze these proposals, is that it's very subjective. The data on it is, at this point, not very good, and we need to be very careful as we analyze these things, and I really appreciate that last comment.
The economic theory would indicate that it would have an equal chance of adding revenue as reducing revenue. But I'm saying many econometric models go way off, and then some things you have to use economic theory and logic.
We've run into that problem.
Hey, Representative Barr, I asked if there were scientific studies. There aren't. They're just economic studies. All right, thank you. Let's bring up Eric Blackledge, Daryl Fuller, and Don Schellenberg. And Don, if you want to bring up Mr. Sersofsky. Yeah, let's bring up an extra chair here to try and move this along. We will go late today. Members, we're on the floor at 11, and I apologize for the time here, but obviously we misjudged our pace today, but I want to make sure everyone who is here to testify on the bills that are on the agenda will have a chance to testify today. All right. Blackledge, welcome
Mr.
back.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is Eric Blackledge, owner of Blackledge Furniture in Corvallis, and I'd like to support passage of House Bill 2505 from two perspectives. First, I support the bill from a small business perspective. As Vice Chairman of the Oregon Governor's Small Business Council and as the Northwest Region Taxation Chair for the U.S. Small Business Administration Office of Advocacy, I support the bill because high capital gains taxes have a significant negative impact on small business people, and Oregon has the second highest capital gains tax rate in the nation. Small businesses are the heart of Oregon's economy and account for over 97% of Oregon businesses with employees and over 60% of total state employment. The Governor's Small Business Council has consistently recommended a reduction in the capital gains tax to stimulate new business growth. Salaried workers receive many tax-sheltered incentives to save for their retirement, such as 401k plans, Roth IRAs, or the public retirement system. Small business people, usually out of necessity, have to invest most of their retirement assets into their businesses or properties, which after paying taxes year after year, then again get taxed at the full tax rate on the capital gain in the year that they sell them. Capital gains taxes are particularly inequitable because a significant percentage of the capital gain, the taxable gain, is often just inflation. If I buy a property or other asset as a way of saving for my retirement that costs $100,000 now, that might pay for 50 months of living at today's costs, and just if it inflates at the general inflation rate over 15 or 20 years, it might technically be worth $200,000, but it will still only pay for 50 months of equally inflated living expenses. And after paying a 9% tax on the $100,000 of inflationary gain, it wouldn't even buy 46 months of living expenses. I also support the bill from an economic development perspective. As the past chair of the Tax and Public Policy Committee of the Oregon Emerging Business Initiative in 1999, and as a member of Governor Kitzhaber's last tax system policy advisory group, I support the bill because Oregon's high capital gains tax rate reduces the availability of capital and management expertise for new business development in the state. When faced with a high capital gains tax, successful entrepreneurs who have built a business and are ready to sell it are actually given a financial incentive of 9% of the increased value of their business to leave Oregon for states such as Washington or Florida that have no state income tax. The tax savings are often enough to buy their new home and give them an incentive to move. Some owners also relocate successful small businesses to other states in anticipation of rapid value growth to completely avoid the capital gains tax. Many of these successful business people also later start new businesses or provide mentoring and investment capital to other startup businesses in their home state. Losing these successful entrepreneurs is a major long-term loss for the Oregon economy. Most individuals with substantial capital gains also have other taxable income and probably pay far more in income taxes and property taxes than they use in state services. These are the kinds of citizens we should be trying to attract to Oregon, not drive away. In 1986, when the federal tax code was revised to replace the 60% capital gains exclusion, which also used to apply on the Oregon income tax, with lower tax rates for all sources of income, Oregon's tax rate on capital gains effectively doubled. Congress has further reduced federal taxes on capital gains to encourage savings, investment, and economic growth. We all know the state is experiencing a budget crisis, and you're going to have to deal with that reality. And current economic forecasts are not strong. But I hope you will remember that the long-term economic consequences of poor tax policy can be very negative for the state in terms of its business climate, its business success, and as a result, the revenue that it generates for the state's services. Even if Oregon can't quickly reduce the capital gains tax burden, we can at least adopt House Bill 2505 to show potential investors that a gradual reduction will occur and that Oregon is a good place to grow a business, contrary to the current image that we have. It is time to follow the federal model and return fairness and balance to Oregon's tax on capital gains by slowly returning to the 5% rate. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Blackledge. Daryl Fuller.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Daryl Fuller. I represent the Oregon Auto Dealers Association, although today I'm here in my capacity as president of the Oregon Small Business Coalition. I want to thank Associated Oregon Industries for having introduced House Bill 2505 and indicate that our support in the... recognition of the time crunch that you're in, I want to just tell you I liked everything he said and indicate that my comments are more along the lines of perception and reality. The perception that people have of the state of Oregon is that it's not a good place to do business, and until the state of Oregon starts creating a new perception, we cannot create a new reality of economic growth in the state of Oregon. As long as investors do not have confidence in their ability to make money over and above the 9% capital gains tax, there is no incentive for them to invest the funds they have in the state of Oregon. And if we can take small steps, even small steps, at fostering a pro-business, a pro-growth, and a pro-economic recovery attitude from the state government, it will go a long way towards, I think, pushing us into an economic recovery mode where we are not currently perceived that way. And we are faced with, I think, a negative perception beyond just at the state level when the solution to our economic downturn at the local level appears to be more revenue through higher taxes and higher fees at the local level. And that just makes it that much more difficult for existing businesses to stay afloat and for consumers, investors to have confidence. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. I wanted to build on Mr. Blackledge's comments a little bit. Mr. Chair, when you were back in junior high, oh, I thought that might catch his attention.
I remember those 10 years very well.
Yeah, we did have a favorable treatment of capital gains. And it was about that time in 1968, as Mr. Blackledge referred to, that Senator Packwood from Oregon was chair of the Senate, I don't know, Revenue and Finance Committee or whatever they call it at the U.S. Senate level. He had a big tax reform bill. And in that tax reform bill, they changed from excluding 50% of the capital gain to not excluding any capital gain, but instead cutting the capital gain tax rate in half. That was 1986. 1987, the Oregon legislature met, and they did their reconnect bill, like you've been doing, and they reconnected to the federal rules, but they didn't lower the tax rate. And so we, at that point, doubled the capital gain tax rate in Oregon, and that's where we've been ever since. It's time that we go back to our roots and get back in sync with the federal government on this particular issue in House Bill 2505. Oregon Farm Bureau does support that bill. With me today, again, is Mr. Don Sersofsky, a member of our Tax Advisory Committee at the Oregon Farm Bureau, and he would have some comments to make as well.
Yeah, well, thank you for allowing me to come testify before you on this bill. As a grass seed producer in Willamette Valley, I would like you to show you how a rate reduction could benefit a family-owned grass seed farm. The current prices for grass seed are currently several cents below the actual cash cost of production. Currently, grass seed growers are surviving on the reserve from previous years' better markets. Larger and larger operating loans are needed to cover the costs of production. Banks will extend credit only so far. It is quite possible that family farmers will soon have to resort to selling a portion of that farm to save the rest. It is then that the reduction of rates on capital gains become of paramount importance. I offer you this example. Suppose a family farmer decides to sell 80 acres of his 100,000-acre farm to cover his increased debt. He sells the parcel for $2,500 an acre. This is a parcel he bought 25 years ago for $1,000 per acre. In this case, he pays a gain on $120,000. At the current 9% rate, he will pay $10,800 in capital gains tax. If the rate were reduced to 5%, that tax would be reduced to $6,000, a savings of $4,800, which could be paid against the principal of that bank loan. To you, it may not seem like much, but it could make the difference between satisfying the bank for another year or having to liquidate even more of his assets. This scenario looks even darker if you look forward in the operation of the farm. This family farmer now has lost 8% of his production base. He has 80 fewer acres in which to produce his crops to provide a living for his family. The chances of recovering those acres are very slim. If he manages to survive this downturn in the market, he is in a much weaker position to survive the next downturn. A reduction in the rate of capital gains is essential, especially in times of economic downturns. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you. Don, I just wanted to make one note that in the, after the federal 86 tax law, that Oregon's economy doubled since then. And had some of the largest expansion directly after that, and particularly in the 90s, with or without that change in tax policy. And the capital gains tax is actually higher in California, yet they seem to attract a lot of business that we would like to come here. So I just, I'm not connecting the dots. And I personally think that capital gains shouldn't be taxed on inflation. And I do think there's a legitimate argument there, but I'm not sure if the argument is one that is that it will somehow create new business or create new jobs. I mean, there's just no credible evidence that that would happen in a small state like Oregon. I just throw that out to you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hass, that's not the argument that we were making, and I agree with you definitely that most of our, as the example that Mr. Sosofsky gave, that's inflation. There's nothing that was done to make that property worth any more today than it was when he bought it. It's all inflation, and I certainly agree with you that we shouldn't be imposing a tax on inflation. As I don't know that we were alleging, we haven't alleged that there would be more jobs in agriculture necessarily. All we're trying to do is save the family farm and not be taxed out of business.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Haas, maybe I might add to that to comment also, and that is that clearly economic growth can occur regardless of the tax situation in a particular state. It is such a multifaceted equation in terms of what leads to economic success that no one element can really be assigned responsibility. Going back to the earlier questions you were asking about the different alternatives in terms of tax reduction, it's very hard to say which is going to have the greatest impact on Oregon's economy. But I can tell you that the capital gains tax rate has the greatest impact on those businesses most likely to truly grow and be more successful in the future. Those businesses that are considered to be gazelles, the high technology companies, the software companies, the companies that are really going to grow the new economy, that are going to be responsible for job growth in the future, those are the ones which are the most impacted by capital gains, because those are the ones which are going to grow the most and have the most capital gains impact. So I can tell you that the capital gains tax rate clearly at least has the most impact on those businesses we would probably most like to attract to Oregon in the future, and that if we do not change that rate, we are less likely to attract those creme de la creme businesses.
If I could just, do you think that's a marketing feature as much as it's economic tax policy? In other words, if we can kind of advertise that, you know, come to Oregon or stay in Oregon because we have a low capital gains, and that's a very different issue than doing something that's good policy.
In a sense, it is marketing. Any new business thinking of locating in a state looks at a chart very similar to the ones that you get from the Department of Revenue that shows how Oregon compares on each of the different kinds of taxes. And when they look over to that capital gains column, if they're a business that's going to be very stable, not have much capital gain, not grow much, that's not very important. They look instead at regular income tax rates, various property taxes, various other factors. But for those businesses that are really expect to grow significantly and to have a great growth in value and therefore employment and assets and everything else, they go right to that capital gains column and they see how we compare to other states. And that has a big role in their decision.
Mr. Chair, if I just want to follow up. I agree with you that it probably is more of a marketing function, and I don't think that's a bad thing. But if marketing is really what we want to do to attract and if it's an economic development strategy, then I think we also have to work on marketing our state as a state that doesn't close schools down early, and a state that has a solid transportation system, and a state that has a high quality of life, because whatever the economic development strategy is, and this has been researched, AOI did a study with Willamette University, that businesses do care about taxes. They care a lot about tax rates, but not as much as they care about amenities and the quality of life. And the bottom line is companies don't want to stay or go to a place where the schools are bad and the freeways are crowded and the rivers are crowded.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Haas, I would have to agree with you. Clearly, those things have a major impact, again, on exactly the kind of business, that gazelle business that I was talking about. And I'm not suggesting that Oregon necessarily needs to have an overall reduction in its tax rate. I'm simply suggesting that of the different kinds of taxes that Oregon has, the capital gains tax is one which is currently out of proportion with other states, needs to be reduced and probably replaced, and I think that is the reality, with some other broader-based form of tax to support broad-based public services such as education.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll call up Jason Williams, Jim Haynes.
Chair Scott, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Williams, Executive Director of the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. I know we're running short on time, so I'll be very brief. As has been said, with having the second highest capital gains tax in the nation, it does make us very unattractive to come here, and it makes us very attractive to leave here when it comes time to sell your capital gains. And since I've been involved in this issue over the last few years, I always get, every now and then, a phone call or someone that will tap my shoulder at a conference and say, you know what? When it came time for us to sell our business or our rental property, I'm embarrassed to say it, but we left the state. We jumped right across the river to Vancouver. Housing was cheaper, and that difference in capital gains was big enough that we decided we just had to do it. And just to think about that, there are scores of people who are leaving the state when it comes time to make that big tax contribution. And when they're making that big decision to sell that property or sell that a stock or sell that business, they actually leave the state. They go across that river, and that is money out of the our economy. That's money away from state revenue. And it also, I think if people talk about it, people use these investments for their retirement and also emergencies. Just recently I had a lady call me, and she talked about how her dad basically was hit with this incredible illness, and his hospital bills are over $50,000 a year. So they had no choice but to sell the family business. And the capital gains was about $70,000 on selling that business, which means that's a whole year of medical cost. So these things really hurt. And the other thing I just want to mention is that last week I had the privilege and honor to go to Washington, D.C. and even visit the White House, where I had a chance to meet some of the people involved with the Congressional Budget Office and the Treasury Department. And they're kind of showing how our economy, how the consumer spending has been able to keep it from being a lot worse. And one area that's really hurting is business and business investment. And that is really slowing down our economy. And then if we don't fix that business investment, we're not going to have the recovery that we need. And one of the best ways to get business investment right back on track is cutting capital gains taxes. But as you guys think about that with House Bill 2505, which we encourage you to support, just remember there are people that when it comes down to them making the big decision in their life, there are a lot of people that go right across the river, and we lose that economy, we lose that income, we lose those folks. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Vice Chair Scott and members of the committee. My name is Jim Haynes. I'm an independent public relations and business reputation management consultant, and I live in Sherwood, Oregon. I don't have any facts or figures or data-rich charts for you today, but I do urge you to support the reduction of capital gains taxes. There's been some talk of economic theories, but let me talk in economic reality as a small business entrepreneur. Business investment is the dollars and cents engine that ultimately allows my family to pay our taxes, to buy food and clothing, support my elderly mother, and other necessities and a little bit of leisure in life. By giving businesses a greater incentive to invest and to reinvest in the state, you will help keep that reality for me. Let me give you a theoretical example based on some things that have gone on in my community, which, as you know, Sherwood is one of the fastest, has been one of the fastest growing communities in the state. I'm fortunate to live there. It's a great little town, and it's becoming a real city. But for example, a farmer who we used to buy hay to feed our horses down in Sherwood sold part of his property for development. Obviously, that generates capital gains. Because of the tax, the various expenses, including taxes, that he had to pay on that sale, he was not able to go forward with his plan to develop a business park in that area. Now, had he been able to do that, develop that park near where I live, and a fellow that I know and I've done business with, I feel he would have been more able to invest in not only the construction workers to build it, but also long-term in my profession to work with me on developing a marketing program, developing news media information, developing customer collateral information that ultimately I bill by the hour and would have helped pay my bills. So here's a real-world example of how his inability to feel capable to invest in a new business in Sherwood has limited my ability to generate revenue that I put back into the economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, questions? Okay. Chuck Shetoff and Patrick Green. And not to try and reduce, but we're running quite late.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Charles Sheketoff, Executive Director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy, here in opposition to this bill. Staff is handing out to you two new reports from the Oregon Center for Public Policy. The first one is called The Wrong Answer for Oregon's Economy that we released in late February on why cutting capital gains income taxes will harm the economy. The next one is a report we just released this week, which addresses the anecdotal evidence and the claims by Mr. Williams and others that there's this big flight of people to Washington State to avoid our capital gains tax. Well, instead of relying on anecdotal evidence, we looked at IRS migration data and show that it isn't scores or multiple. I guess it's a score because if you don't look at incoming, because it's 357 households average go there. But they also have flight of people into Oregon. Over half of that is offset by people coming into Oregon. We are not losing significant resources or people or investments to Washington State. And last, I'll call your attention to a report I distributed at your overview presentation called Cutting Capital Gains Taxes Will Hurt Not Help Oregon's Economy, which has further analysis. My comments will be brief. First, I want to remind you that in the 1990s, Oregon had one of the hottest economies in the country. In fact, from 1995 to 2000, we had the hottest economy, fastest growing economy in terms of GSP per capita with our capital gains tax. Comment was made earlier that when we say it's targeted to the rich, we're wrong, that look at the distribution of who has capital gains. It's not who has them, it's the amount they have of capital gains taxes that matters. It's sort of like it doesn't matter whether you're double taxing or single taxing, it's the total tax rate that matters. And in fact, if you look at distribution analyses in our reports and ones by LRO, you'll see that for 80% of the taxpayers, they get virtually nothing. They average around $10 for a capital gains tax cut such as this, where the wealthiest get the most. And so if you sort of imagine going to a meeting of 100 constituents this weekend and saying to 80 of the people there, you're not going to get much, but the one of you is pretty lucky, the top 1%, you'll get most of it. This is not a targeted tax cut. This has nothing to do with investments in Oregon. This is just a capital gains tax cut. Doesn't matter whether the money gets invested. It's actually a jobless credit for a jobless recovery. How does it hurt the Oregon economy? Well, if you even, our report discusses even different analyses of there have been a number of studies. I don't know if economics is a science. I think it actually is. It's not a hard science for sure. But there have been a number of studies about economic development. If you look at those, the projection of any economic gain in Oregon would be more than offset by the higher federal taxes those getting the tax cut would have to pay, would have to send to Washington to support the war and other efforts. Their federal taxes go up when you cut the state taxes, and it goes up. And this was targeted even for more than on across the board, because the tax cuts targeted at the wealthy who itemize and have high taxes on a progressive federal tax. So at first, you're losing more in federal taxes than you're gaining in economic development. Second, the lost revenue, as other speakers will talk to, is important to our budget. And we've calculated that if you just assume, and I think it's a fair assumption, that lost revenue gets spread across the board, that we're not going to have a dramatic shift in how much goes to education versus human services and public safety over time. For every dollar of lost dollars, we lose $40 of federal dollars coming in. Of course, those come in mostly through the Department of Human Services, Medicaid, match. One quarter of the state budget is DHS, and the biggest share of DHS is Medicaid. Sometimes that department's called the Department of Medicaid match. So you're losing those federal dollars. That's new money into the economy. Your last revenue forecast, this committee knows that what drives budgets are population increases and inflation. Your last revenue forecast showed that we will not catch up to the 99.01 revenue levels on a per capita basis when adjusting for, we won't catch up to it, to the 99.01 level when adjusting for population and inflation until after the 07-09 biennium, when this one really kicks in. I'd like to respond to a few of the earlier comments very quickly. First, again, seniors, our report that we issued last October shows the distribution is most of the benefits go to the seniors who have $100,000 of income or above, that it's still targeted to the wealthiest. It's no different with seniors. This isn't targeted. AOI's testimony said that I had, or referred to a comment I had made, but that inflated it by 50%. It said that I had said 36,000 C corporations don't pay taxes. No, it's 23,000 didn't pay taxes in 2000. They came up with all these reasons I don't agree with on why that's so, but if they're not afraid of the reasons for why that's so, then perhaps they'll be back before this committee supporting corporate tax disclosure. But I doubt it, because I think they'd be embarrassed by the results. A comment was made earlier about the 1986 Tax Reform Act and changing capital gains. I'd also remind you that that was the law that Senator Packwood, then chair of the Finance Committee, changed the way we tax corporations because of corporate tax disclosure a few years prior to that. And we increased the ability to, we got rid of a lot of the loopholes in the corporate tax code. AOI handed out Article 1, their attachment to their testimony is very revealing about this plastics company that moved to the port of Vancouver. First, it shows it was really not much of a job loss. They lost one person isn't making the move. It's not clear about the new jobs that might form there, whether they come from Oregon or Vancouver. But maybe even more importantly, the article says he chose the site because of the landlord and opportunity to cut overhead. We looked at several options but found the Port of Portland is more willing to work with you. Oh, we reduced overhead costs. That gets to the point I raised with you in my overview testimony, that it's not taxes. There's a whole bunch of other reasons companies move, and taxes are a small player. And in fact, this company sort of fits into that Amazon example where they're moving to us. They may have not paid any taxes. They may be in that two-thirds of corporations that pay the $10 minimum in Oregon, but they're going to a state where they're going to have to pay gross receipts taxes, regardless of whether they have profits. So I'd also a little curious that the Farm Bureau's up here again asking for a capital gains tax cut. Last session you gave them one for farmers that liquidate. You lowered the tax on that. It's a little bit curious, because I'm not sure if lowering the tax encourages liquidation of farming, and I always thought the rhetoric around the building was, let's keep people in the farming business. But you liquidate and you get a capital gains tax cut, so they're back at the trough again. And I just don't believe that Oregon's revenue situation can do it. It's not targeted. We don't need a jobless tax credit for a jobless recovery that harms the state budget and the economy of Oregon. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Chuck. If I can, committee, I've asked Paul to see if we can be excused from the floor. Assuming that that's the case, go get some more coffee and sit back.
Enjoy the ride.
But that doesn't mean that we don't want to proceed with this patch. So, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Shetterly, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Patrick Green with the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I will also attempt to be brief. What I'd like to talk about is capital gains in terms of the overall distribution of wealth between rich and poor, as well as focus on the creation of jobs or lack thereof from this tax cut. We're in opposition of House Bill 2505 because we don't believe that capital gains tax cuts do anything but or do much more than exacerbate the already growing discrepancy between rich and poor. I have an article from February 7, 2002, New York Times, talking about the results of the national, the federal capital gains tax cuts. And it said that an IRS from IRS income tax data for the 5 years through 1999, the latest year available, that the wealthiest Americans paid a smaller share of their income in taxes because in 1997 Congress reduced taxes on capital gains, which account for a significant share of their income, and that the 400 richest taxpayers of all harvested 7% of all capital gains in 1998. These very rich Americans paid just 22% of their income in taxes that year, down from 30% in 1994. And then if you look at, in terms of does the capital gains tax cut work or what, in fact, does it do, I have a quote from Joel Slemrod, who wrote Taxing Ourselves, A Citizen's Guide to the Great Debate Over Tax Reform, which I would recommend. And apparently he's not particularly wild-eyed. There's praise from Bruce Bartlett of the Wall Street Journal for his book, saying it's the best book on taxation I have ever read. So what does Mr. Slemrod say? He says in terms of capital gains helping the economy, Joel Slemrod from the University of Michigan says, quote, the idea of cutting capital gains tax to move the economy significantly is implausible, unquote. He said, and then he goes on to talk about it's too, even at the federal level, it's too small a shift for an $8 trillion economy. And I would just place Oregon, if you look at our overall economy and looking in the face of an $8 trillion economy, what we would be able to do. And then Alan Auerbach, a professor at the University of Berkeley, says that the impact of the capital gains tax is highly attenuated. Stocks held until death are exempt from the capital gains tax, which is watered down further by being imposed only after investments are sold. I think that, to echo what Chuck said, if we must do it, if we think that it actually works, and I think that that's I think that the jury is still out on that, we should target it towards Oregon entrepreneurs, towards investment in Oregon, not investment in a Chinese company or investment in a German company or investment in a company outside of Oregon. Let's target it. If we believe in our entrepreneurs, let's focus on investment in our entrepreneurs. There's nothing in here that guarantees that this would create jobs. We're not rewarding people for creating jobs. In terms of the hostile tax environment here in Oregon, I just remind folks about the 2003 Competitiveness Red Book from the state of Washington, which includes their Association of Washington Business and the Washington Association of Realtors. It says that Oregon has the lowest overall tax burden in the West, and which gets me to just a couple more items. One is from this book that says that expanding the preferential treatment of capital gains provides no incentive to buy new stock or new real estate, and instead just provides a windfall gain for past decisions. Any new preference should, if feasible, be restricted to new gains. And that gets to the issue of focusing on tax investment to begin with. But I would just say that because of our low tax burden, one of the things is I feel like you know, every time we come here and listen to AOI and others come, they talk about how hostile Oregon is for business. We've had people talk to you directly as a legislature. You need to think like business people, as if you don't already or as if you don't understand it. And I, for one, am tired of people coming in and saying that we're hostile to business. It's almost like talking down your own stock. We are the lowest in the West. There's the example of Amazon. People think of other reasons to move other than just the tax code. And also, I think the argument could be made, if you want to just talk about the overall tax burden, that the state of Oregon is hostile to workers or individual taxpayers, because they're paying a growing share of the overall tax burden, 60% for individuals and 40% to corporations, when it used to be 50-50. I'm not going to make that argument, but it just goes to say that the rhetoric is a little out of control when we talk about how hostile we are towards business. With that, I'll close. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Lori, have you spoken yet?
Not yet.
Okay.
Good morning. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen with the Oregon Education Association, echoing my colleague's opposition to House Bill 2505 and actually to the other two that were on the schedule for today as well. The chair talks about a balancing act, and we couldn't agree more that the important job for all of you is to achieve that balancing act between economic recovery ideas on one hand and supporting the important infrastructure for the state on the other. And we think that the balancing act with respect to this bill is very lopsided. In education, just to give you an example of something I know a little about, right now in the Ways and Means Committee, they're talking about a $4.5 billion budget statewide for K-12. Now, I will remind you that the close of session budget for K-12 at the end of 2001 was 5.2. This is 4.5. According to the Department of Education numbers that I saw the other day, that could result in an 8,000 teacher job loss in this state if that's the budget level. I want to say that again. 8,000 jobs lost. Now, from my understanding of the data, this capital gains tax cut proposal can't show you data of a significant gain with that $24 million we'll lose in the next biennium alone under that bill. And that $24 million would only drive up that number of job losses. And that's just one of the most important and most critical economic development drivers, I would argue, that the state really needs to sustain and bolster for the coming years in order to stay out of the Doonesbury cartoons and to attract the best and brightest to Oregon and the corporations that provide those family wage jobs. On the business side, the data has not been persuasive that those kinds of job numbers are going to result from the tax cuts that have been before you today, any of the three. Representative Haas made all my best arguments for me in the form of his questions earlier. I'd like to thank him for that. We believe that it would be unconscionable to pass a tax cut that in 2007-09 would result in a $383 million static loss of revenue for the state of Oregon, when we have no guarantees that we'll be out of the trough we're in now to any measurable degree, and we'll be, in like all likelihood, continuing to struggle with these issues in this financial crisis. Or if not a financial crisis, it may have diminished enough to just call it still a big challenge. We agree also that the best economic recovery tool for Oregon is, in fact, our public education system. And you may all recall that I gave you an Equal Northwest study that we had commissioned last spring that showed you precisely, with data yet again, what public education does with respect to contributing to Oregon's economy every day in every community in the state. And we think that anything that further threatens our ability to deliver in that regard and to produce children who grow up to be the workforce of tomorrow is, as I said, unconscionable. So with that, I'll close. I won't take too much more of your time, except to remind you that we also have given you our $1 million list. You can double the impact of every single bullet on this list with respect to just the impact in the next biennium alone of this cut. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, we have been excused from the floor, so unless you're carrying one of our revenue bills that's up, you're free to relax down here and continue to enjoy the scintillating conversation. Are there questions for this panel?
Oh,
yes.
I don't know if maybe I do have a question.
See, now that we know we have another hour, we're just going to...
That's my call.
We're going to start calling on people.
In 1969... my family sold everything they had, and we moved to Oregon and went in business. So I'm one of those people that came to Oregon. For the last 34 years, we have provided family wage jobs, good jobs, not minimum wage jobs, for anywhere from 35 to 50 employees, depending on which line of business we were handling at that time. I think my problem here is that I don't feel that Oregon has Oregonians. I don't think Oregonians have an anti-business atmosphere. I think they connect business to schools. I think business success is one of the best things in the world for schools, because you have income taxes that are going to support your schools, but that doesn't even touch the community support that you get outside of the taxes that support your schools. One of the biggest challenges in Oregon in your schools has been the success of Oregon. You have created growth in these areas of Oregon where you have all of this growth, and you've outgrown your buildings. You need capital improvements. So success has been a little part of some of the things that you've experienced in the central part of the state. I believe that we are adversarial, however, to workers. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. I believe that we have people who we might term the working poor. They work 5 and 6 days a week. The wife has to have a job because they can't make it without that. And yet the state says we must have more taxes from you. And they're not willing to give it. And I think that the dilemma here for me on a committee is not only the balance, Laurie, that you talked about, which I think is extremely important, but it's also to not constantly turn to people who are working very hard and trying to say that they need to supply the money. We need to create more jobs. Now, I don't want to get into that long discussion, but one thing I would like to say, for those of you who are saying we need more jobs, business needs to be connected to jobs, I want to know not what you're against, but I want to know what you're for. And I think that that's a fair request as we plod through this. I am disturbed that we have not had in the building the discussion of how we're going to fund schools. And we're already talking about how we're going to build buildings. And I want to know how we're going to take care of children. Because everybody is pro something. But if you watched a movie last night, I thought the line was classic. It was, who is pro-child? And I think that we need to have some discussions. But I think they have to be far more on the pro side for me than on the anti side. And I think we need to start thinking much more in terms of workers and their connection to business that's successful, and that successful business connected to schools.
Right. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to respond for a second. I think that we will be able to offer you something that we are for, and we look forward to that opportunity as those bills get scheduled and as our Oregon Revenue Coalition panel comes forward with a presentation on April 4th.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Verger, we also are, what we're for is those of us who spend a lot of time at the other end of the hall on the Ways and Means process recognize that state government plays an important role in the economy in this state, whether it's education funding and how money goes from the metro area to the rest of the state, whether it's unemployment insurance taxes that get collected in the metro area and go out to help the hurt in rural Oregon. Whether it's Department of Human Services bringing in Medicaid dollars. Those are federal dollars that come in just because when we spend a dollar, it's $2 match. Sometimes on some small programs, up to $9 a match for each dollar we spend. Food stamps is 100% federal dollars. 50% of the administrative costs, which are minimal, are picked up by the federal government. And so we're for those things. Your concern for the working poor, I There's no one in this building who's a stronger advocate for the working poor than I am. That's why we've pushed, as the chair and other members of the committee know, for expanding and making better the earned income tax credit. This bill would do nothing to help the working poor, virtually nothing. And well, it doesn't create jobs for them. It allows investments anywhere in the world. And so and that's also a reason why we've said on Measure 28, Measure 28 was designed to get most of its revenue not from the working poor. In fact, we did a critique of Governor Kitzhaber's across-the-board tax increase and said, don't do that. Just raise the top rate. I'm not going to say we are the absolute reason the legislature did, but I know a number of people looked at that, and that was the result. And by raising just the top rate, that tax increase was not targeted at the employees you've had. It was targeted at upper income, primarily. And so we're for a lot of things. What we're trying to do is stop the leaks and stop the misdirected stuff that's being used in the name of economic development. Any, you know, sort of like any tax break is economic development. It just doesn't fly.
Okay, I can get us excused from the floor, but I can't get us excused from lunch. So we're going to have to move on. I want to thank you. I have one more witness on this bill, and then we will finish with House Bill 3183. This is Gwyneth Van Frank Carlson. Okay. Good morning.
Good morning. So my name is Gwyneth Van Frank Carlson, and I'm here from Eugene, Oregon. And today I'm wearing many hats under this one. One is that my husband and I are general contractors, bonded and licensed for all structures. And we have a business, a family business, in Eugene. I'm also a small business owner on my own, Catalyst Works, which provides disability resource training and presentations. And I'm also a member of Support Oregon Services Alliance and Lane Independent Living Alliance, which are disability-related organizations. So I am here, as I said, wearing many hats and sitting on both sides of the fence as a business owner, small business, and as a person who has benefited in the past from human services, no amount of capital gains tax or income on my part or my family's part has provided the rehabilitation services that I received when I suddenly went blind at the age of 30. Those were provided by the state, and since it's such a specialized rehabilitation process, there are no or few, I'm one of them now, rehabilitation teachers available in the state for people who discover that they're suddenly dealing with a shift that happened in their lives. So, oh, I forgot one more hat. I'm also a landlady. My husband and I own rental property, and so capital gains tax has been an issue for us. But considering the fact that we sit on both sides of the fence, we support, oh yeah, we also have children, two children who go to school. And my daughter, who is a middle schooler, has 40 children in her math class, one teacher, no aid, and not enough time, not enough desks, not enough books, and not enough time for the teacher to correct her math papers. So she does not have really a clear idea of how well she's doing. So I have a lot of fingers and a lot of pies. And the one thing I'm not here is a paid lobbyist. I'm coming to the Capitol because it is so essential to me to get across the message that human services, that the government, my opinion is that the government is not a business and should not operate as one. It is a service provider, and it needs to do its job and have the revenue to do that. It provides education for my children. It provided rehabilitation to me. It provides a quality of life to our family business. That is the reason we have invested our lives, our money, and our commitment to Oregon. And I do not support a capital gains tax cut or any other kinds of revenue cuts that will impede the ability of Oregon's government to provide the services that it needs. It won't, as Chuck so aptly put, It's not targeted to make sure that there are jobs here in Oregon. And there are many, many low-paid workers who work very hard who are not able to purchase health care. And people with disabilities are even much less likely to be able to purchase health care, not only because of their income, not only because of their incomes, which tend to be low for most people, but also because once you go out into the private sector and work, it's very difficult to purchase insurance if you have a disability. And so healthcare is one of those services that is not replaceable from any other source than the government. So I would like to set my opposition to this bill. Thank you. And I'll leave my cards with someone. Good lane.
Grab those. And just, if you want to stay right there, Paul can get them from you. Thank you, Ms. Van Frank. Carlson.
Yes. I'm Mrs. Carlson and Ms. Van Frank.
You know, should have signed up twice for that testimony. We will then close the public hearing on House Bill 2505 and move to a public hearing on House Bill 3183. Elizabeth, if you'll give us the brief overview of that as we call Paul Phillips. And Paul, if you want to bring your group up, we'll put four chairs there. Don Lance, Al Logan, and Eric Amos. Appreciate your patience in waiting through the morning's agenda.
Mr. Chairman, with House Bill 3183, what you have here is a corporate apportionment formula change. So as we've talked about during orientation and everything, we now have an 80% corporate apportionment formula, 80% sales factor, and that is beginning in May of 2003. What this bill is going to do is increase that sales factor to 90%, and then the payroll and property factors will be 5%, and that would begin May 1st, 2005. Then it's going to increase that sales factor to 100% beginning May 1st of 2007.
Okay. Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I very much appreciate you getting excused so we could present to you. You see a lot of me, so I'll be brief and set the stage and let the fellows that came from around different parts of the state. For the record, my name is Paul Phillips. I represent the Smart Growth Coalition. We have here today Monica Coach, Columbia Sportswear. We also have Tektronix and Intel, Geldwin, Snitzer, Louisiana Pacific, Cascade Corporation, and Mr. Chair, our presenter there had to leave for a funeral, but I've attached his testimony for you. Goldendale Electric, Nike is here today. ESI, Les Schwab, TriQuint, Precision Cast Parts, FEI, Lithia, Bear Creek, the Greenbrier Corporation, and KinderCare. And we also work closely with associations, AEA, the Bankers Association, the Metals Council. Mr. Chair, this is a great opportunity for us to come before you and talk about a bill. I'm sorry you're exhausted, and there's not much humor I can put into it to entertain you, but I'll do my best. For those of you that were in the body in 1999, you'll recall that Oregon House and Senate passed 100% sales factor on a widely bipartisan measure that ran into a little problem in the central office when he declared that the Oregon's economy was strong and we didn't need to create any jobs. In 2001, we came back and passed 100% and then compromised at 80%, and that was signed thanks in large part to Senator Brown and Representative Gardner and Representative Corey, who interceded on our behalf. The concepts that were positive then are positive now, and now we'd like to phase in to 100%. The difference being is we recognize from counsel we received from you, Mr. Chair, that going to 100% this biennium and having a fiscal impact is improbable. So what we've done is phase it in over a period of time. This fits the mode that I mentioned on Tuesday of the 1983 unitary tax, the 1989 double weight changes, and the work we did in 2001. The Smart Growth Coalition comes before you because we're concerned from a statewide perspective of economic development and tax policy on the long term. The factors we look at are income generations, jobs protected and created, and the stability and competitive position nationally of Oregon businesses. Our priorities, single sales number one, then R&D, which you heard, and investment tax credit. The focus is to keep businesses here, keep them open and recruit new headquarter businesses. It is interesting that we often hear from folks that government plays an important role in the economy. It does. But without a strong business community generating income, there is no money for government. Therefore, we're really focusing on what House Bill 3183 does. And the primary thing that it does is remove the penalty that is inherent in Oregon's tax code for corporations who invest in payroll and property. If you have an 80% sales, 10% property, and 10% payroll, those put you at a disadvantage. When we want people to invest and we want people to hire folks in this state, those are the factors that we are concerned about. But I would draw to your attention, Mr. Chair, the national competitive issue. On the material that I gave you, there's a map. And on that map, there's lots of good colors. The pink or salmon color is single-weighted. Those in blue, and you'll notice Washington, Oregon, and California are in blue, are contemplating going to a single sales. Right behind there, I gave the corporate headquarters created on that map. It's an interesting parallel that those with single sales do much, much better expanding their businesses and recruiting others. Furthermore, from a competitive nature, with the state of Washington looking to modernize their sales apportionment, their corporate apportionment, which means they're going to focus on local generation, which means sales locally, we now have a real issue of where we are competitively on the West Coast. That's why this bill is before you. We think it's a very positive step to commitment long range. It does not have a fiscal impact. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like just to turn it down the line and let the guys that are here talk about it.
All right. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Don Lance, and I'm the tax director with Monaco Coach Corporation. Monaco is headquartered in Cobourg, just north of Eugene, and we're in the business of manufacturing recreational vehicles. We employ over 3,000 people at our facilities in Oregon, which include facilities in Lane County, Linn County, Deschutes, and Harney counties. These 3,000 employees represent about 50% of our total workforce in the United States. I'm appearing before you today on behalf of Monaco, but also as a native Oregonian that cares about the state. I applaud all of you on your hard work in these tough economic times. Your job's not easy, but obviously very important. The economic challenges you face are twofold. First is the short-term severe financial need that the state faces, but secondly is the long-term need for economic stability. We must be careful not to sacrifice the long-term needs in order to pursue the quick fixes. If we do that, we risk being right back in the situation again. I think most of us would agree that one critical component to establishing long-term economic success is that we need to have successful businesses that can offer stable employment in the state. Where most disagreement occurs is how much the state should get involved in terms of attracting and retaining these businesses. I can tell you from experience that multi-state and multinational corporations have a lot of flexibility over where to locate our operations, and there's a lot of states out there that are just dying to attract us. I believe very strongly that House Bill 3183 is an opportunity for us to communicate to the world that Oregon is open for business, and I think we can get real results in the door. Various factors come into play when you assess where to locate your facilities. I think the tax landscape is certainly one of those large factors, and that's one that I can speak to from experience. There's sort of two prongs that I would look at in terms of making a decision like this. The first is the presence of, or lack thereof, of short-term economic incentives, things like enterprise zone credits or other tax credits that may exist that would provide immediate financial assistance. Those things are important because they help offset that initial investment cost. It takes a significant financial investment to locate facilities anywhere, and to the extent you can get assistance with that, that's extremely important. However, even more important is the general tax system that's in place that you're going to operate under, the long-term benefits. This bill provides those types of long-term benefits because this apportionment change is something that a company would live with forever. It wouldn't expire on them in 2 or 3 years. When they make their decisions and look at where they're going to locate and what rules they're going to operate under, this is one that they can count on. It's there and it's real. Under our current apportionment system, an Oregon-based business that does business in other states and pays tax in other states is at a real disadvantage. The reason for this, it kind of gets back to how apportionment works. And they take your overall state taxable income, and if you think of it as a pie, what they do is each state determines how much of your income relates to activities you have in that state. Because there's a wide variety of different rules involved, what ends up happening, particularly when you have these single sales factor states out there, is you end up with a sum of all the percentages being more than 100%. So what happens is a company ends up paying tax on more than 100% of its income. This is clearly not equitable. What we can do by passing this bill is we can put Oregon-based companies no worse off than they'd be if they located in any other state that has a single sales factor or is contemplating a single sales factor formula. And at the same time, we can put them better off than they would be if they located in a state with the three-factor apportionment. For Monaco specifically, this issue really hits home because we experience, number one, this effect of having the percentages not add up, where we end up paying more tax because we do business in single sales factor states, but also our principal competitor is located in a state that does have a single sales factor. As a result of that, and also the fact that they've got favorable rules even in determining how the sales factor works surrounding a lack of a sales throwback rule, they end up having a very low percentage that they apply to their taxable income and end up paying next to no state income tax. This obviously gives them tremendous financial resources, which they can bring to bear in the market through price adjustments on products, capital investment, and we're at a competitive disadvantage. So we have to try to make up that difference through other means. To date, we've been pretty successful doing that. As the economy tightens and as the marketplace becomes more competitive in terms of pricing, that's becoming more challenging for us to do. Now, while it's true that most multi-state corporations that are based in Oregon would pay less tax under this proposed methodology than they do under the current apportionment system, there also would be additional tax collected from out-of-state companies that choose not to invest in the state in terms of facilities and employees. This again occurs because of how the apportionment factors work. It's basically an average that currently in Oregon takes into account property, it takes into account payroll, and it takes into account sales. Those out-of-state companies don't have payroll or property or very little, and so they bring a couple of zeros in to average against their sales and drive down their percentage that gets allocated to our state. By placing them on a keel or a situation where they have just a sales factor, it's going to actually cause them to pay more tax. We'll also have the additional corporate tax revenue that will be attracted from new businesses that locate in the state. Because we've put a kind of a two-year prospective effective date on this legislation, and because it will then phase in over another two-year period, we've got some time to go out there and promote this and recruit businesses and get them in the door and actually operating and hopefully producing tax revenue before the law actually takes effect. So this would also offset any revenue losses that you'd see to the existing companies. Now, whether or not that would break revenue neutral right away, you know, in year one, or whether it wouldn't, you know, we'd have to do the dynamic modeling and take into account, make projections on, you know, how many people will actually locate in the business, what's the economy going to look like over the next 2 years. But it's very possible that we could get close to break even right away. And if we didn't, at least long term, we should be able to get there quite easily. There is no one magic solution. I've heard it discussed today, well, is this one better or is that one better? Each business is different, and it's really difficult to say which one would be the best one if we had to pick one. However, this one is good, in my opinion, because it does apply and provides benefit to all multi-state businesses that do choose to locate facilities and make an investment in our state. That's a positive. It's a long-term benefit. You hear me talk about multi-state, multinational. You think, what about the small businesses? Well, when we bring in the large companies, they have significant dollars that they can invest. They can create huge additions to the workforce, and that trickles down. The creation of additional jobs, the creation of corporate tax revenue, and the effect on local smaller businesses that are the suppliers of materials and services to these companies, it has just a dynamic effect on our economy. And again, I would just encourage you strongly to support this bill, because we really need to do something here in Oregon to bring more businesses in.
All right. Thank you very much. Let's go on down, and then we'll pick up questions for the panel.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I don't know how much I can add on Don's testimony. That was great. But allow me to...
If you could introduce yourself for the record.
Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Eric Amos. I'm the tax director for Columbia Sportswear Company. We're obviously here in support of this legislation. A brief bit of personal experience with this bill would probably be appropriate at this point. Columbia Sportswear has grown significantly in the last 10 years. And probably the last 4 years, we've doubled the size of our distribution center, and we just recently purchased a new corporate headquarters in Portland as well. Currently, 100% of our product that's shipped anywhere in the United States is shipped out of Portland, Oregon. Currently, our worldwide corporate headquarters is in Portland, Oregon. We have very few investments in other parts of the United States. As a direct result of these investments, however, our Oregon tax liability is roughly twice what it would have been had we invested in either a single sales factor, apportionment state, Nevada, Washington, a variety of other states. So we're essentially being penalized for two things. We're being penalized for creating high-wage jobs in Oregon, and we're being penalized for building a distribution center, which, again, like Don was saying, factors down to the local contractors, the small business owners, and so forth. You are probably saying, well, why did you expand in Oregon then? It certainly wasn't based on the advice I gave to upper management. However, we are a homegrown company. Although we are a public company, the three primary shareholders still own approximately 70% of the company. Our Oregon roots go back to the 40s. And secondarily, it's certainly very difficult and costly to move a company. You're going to lose a lot of talent. Having said that, though, I would stress that other companies don't share our allegiance to the state, particularly a company that's looking for a place to locate due to a mergers and acquisition activity or some other item such as that. This is a complicated concept, and I just want to explain to you that when I had to explain to Gert Boyle that our Oregon tax liability doubled as a direct result of these investments in the state, it's a difficult concept to grasp. So it's just big picture perspective. It's hard for people to understand why investing and hiring people causes your tax liability to go up. In conclusion, I just want to say that we do support House Bill 3183. A few simple reasons. One, it encourages in-state economic development. It encourages you to locate something in Oregon. The corollary is the current system actually encourages you to put something in another state because the effect is it lowers your Oregon tax liability. I've heard lots of questions as how do the various items rank, and I think this one clearly in my mind ranks number one. Would pollution control help us? Yes. Would lowering the capital gains tax rate help us? Yes. But we as a company feel that this is good not only for our company, but good for Oregon as a whole, and that's why we're here today. And finally, I just want to stress another point, that another great side benefit of this is today our tax structure really relies on the corporate tax revenue of in-Oregon corporations. So if the Oregon economy goes down, our reliance on those companies doesn't change. So as goes the Oregon economy, as goes our corporate tax base, this change would really put our tax base at a national level. So the General Motors of the world, their tax revenue would go up. East Coast companies, their tax base would go up in Oregon as well. So it has a lot of side benefits that really make it the right thing to do, in our opinion. Thank you.
Just one question on that doubling of your tax liability. Is that based on current rates, or is that... we've gone to 80% effectively.
Yeah, that was based on the old one.
Okay, so that's not based on where we're going.
Right.
Okay.
No, that certainly helps.
What would the factor be? 80% and let's
probably
say...
Probably would have increased 25% based on the new one.
Okay. All right. Mr. Logan.
Would you tell Chris that?
Yeah, right. Okay, now give the advice.
Would you like to come and do that?
Good morning, Chair Shetterly and committee members. My name is Al Logan. I am the state and local tax manager at Nike, and I'm here today speaking in support of House Bill 3183. I would first like just for the record to note that Nike is heavily invested in this state. We have over 6,000 employees employed in Oregon with a payroll of over $400 million here, and we have personal and real property investments of over $1 billion. And that's why this bill is important to us, because we think that that kind of investment in, that, in this state can drive economic development. We believe that economic development is the key to Oregon's financial health, and byproducts of that development are jobs and investments in this state. And maybe byproducts might not be the best word, but certainly we think that drives our financial health. And we think that economic diversity also smooths the peaks and valleys. If you have a number of different types of companies in this state, while some may be in a down cycle, others will be in an up cycle, and we think that that will have a leveling effect on the revenues that do come into the state. There are three things that I want to talk about briefly on how this bill impacts Oregon. We think it impacts our competitive position with the other states around us. We think that it impacts Oregon taxpayers directly, and I want to talk just briefly on how it impacts Oregon tax revenues. As far as competitive position, returns that were filed last year before we went to the 80% weighting, there was no reason to distinguish Oregon from Idaho and California, our two income tax neighbors. We all used a double-weighted sales factor apportionment, and for a company looking to invest in jobs and capital in a state, there was a penalty to put those jobs and capital in any one of those three states. By moving to a single sales factor, and obviously to the 80% that we're going to, the superweighted, we have distinguished ourselves as the state that wants those investments in Oregon. And by putting those investments in Oregon, you will not increase your tax in Oregon, yet you would in Idaho and California. So we think that distinguishes Oregon. As far as Oregon taxpayers, this definitely acts as an incentive to bring capital in. And it's a unique kind of incentive in the credits incentives area, because generally when states go out to try to attract business, they will put in place employment credits or property tax breaks based on what a company promises to do. And that company may or may not come in and do what they said they did to get those credits, which is the reason why they have a term out there called clawbacks. And many times the state has to go back and get some of that money that they gave to a company because they didn't come in and do the things that they said they were going to do. This incentive is unique in that no benefit goes to any company that doesn't invest in Oregon. If there are not jobs here, or if there's not capital investment here, there is no benefit. Finally, let me talk about just how this impacts Oregon revenue. In the short term, we think this has no impact, because this doesn't take effect until 2005 and then fully in 2007 bienniums. In the long term, I think there's two things to consider. There are a number of university and economic development studies out there that say when states go to a double or superweighted and even a fully 100% sales factor, that they have an impact, that has an impact of 1-3% increase per year on manufacturing jobs, and half again that impact on non-manufacturing jobs. So if you look at the 1.5-4.5% increase on non-agricultural jobs per year, that translates into Oregon jobs of about 24,000 to 72,000 new jobs each year. If you apply a roughly, I think a modest, $30,000 a year wage base to that, you're looking at between $700 million and $2 billion in additional wages added to the tax base just by giving these companies the incentive to invest here. The other thing these studies look at is the impact. It's not immediate, but generally, most of them come out to say that between 2 and 4 years is when you can start to see the benefits, which is another reason why this is spread out into the future so that we don't impact today. Now, I would suggest that this is certainly a good story, but there is a way for us to look at this to say, is it true? Can we rely on this kind of information? And if we look back to the 1989 legislature, They passed a bill moving us from an equal-weighted three-factor formula to our current double-weighted sales factor formula. And a couple of things happened. 91 was when that became effective. And if you look at the multi-state tax filers from 1991 to 1994, you'll see an increase in 12% of the multi-state filers in Oregon. You'll see an increase in 84% in Oregon's tax revenues from those multi-state employers. What you see when you look at 1991 through 1996 in corporate tax receipts is an increase to the state of 131% over that period, where the Oregon gross state product only grew 52%. I would suggest that these numbers indicate that instead of the doomsday predictions that we hear, that this is going to cut into state revenues, that actually quite the opposite happens. We encourage businesses to locate here, to invest here, and to employ here, and that results in additional revenues to the state. I would like to address one thing that you may be thinking about as I say that. The 90s were a boom time across this country, and I think we can most of us can agree on that. And maybe this going to the double-weighted sales factor was just coincidental. I would suggest that that's not the case, because these numbers are numbers from 1991 to 1994 and 1996. And if we remember back in 1991, 92, and 93, we did not elect an incumbent president. We actually elected a new president, and many of the critics at the time said the reason we did that was because our economy wasn't that good. So these numbers for Oregon showing that things were getting better for us actually were in a time when the rest of the nation was not doing as well. I think in conclusion, I'd just like to leave four quick points. This is an incentive for companies to invest in Oregon. It gives Oregon a competitive advantage over its other income tax states that are out here in the West, because the first one to do this is the first one to reap the benefits. If you follow, all you do is make yourself equal to the states that follow. This bill is not effective until 2005 and then fully in 2007, so it has no impact on today's budgetary issues. And I think our history demonstrates that going to a single factor does stimulate the Oregon economy. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair, just for your record, I have attached some of the studies in this booklet that I've given you, so you have those. And I put in the map and their testimony, their written testimony, and Randy Miller's letter of support in that handout that I gave you.
Thank you. Well, before I go to questions, I want to congratulate Representative Verger in successfully carrying one of our revenue bills on the floor while we've been down here. So
it passed without us?
Yeah, without us. How about that? I have questions. Questions? I have one. Lisbeth, on the revenue impact, I see this bill takes effect for tax years beginning May 1 of 2005. Mm-hmm. You show an 0405 static revenue impact of minus 2.4. How do we have that? Where this would only be in effect then for tax year beginning May and June, 2 months of the 0405 fiscal year. How do we lose 2.4 in those 2 months?
That was my question too.
Yeah. Well, let me just look
okay.
at it.
Okay.
I don't remember.
First estimated tax payment for that.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, staff, the reason we picked May 1, that's concurrent to a number of tax filing years, but last year we were assured that if you picked the May date going forward in the last year of the biennium, it would have no revenue impact in that
we'll
biennium.
Take a look at that.
So that's why we were assured of that.
Okay. Other questions for this panel? This is one that's kind of like the pollution control tax credit, not as hard to get around, get our heads around, but it's familiar because we did this, we talked about this last session. All right, if there are no questions, thank you very much for coming forward today. I had two other witnesses that I don't see in the room. For the record, Chuck Shekstoff with Van Frank Carlson. No, anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 3183, Jim Carlson?
Great.
Craven. I'm sorry, Craven. Sorry. Jeez. What happens when we're...
For the record, Jim Craven.
3 hours and 10 minutes into the hearing. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Jim Craven, American Electronics Association. I never want to be the person between people and a drink or people and their lunch, so I'm just going to say I think that was an excellent panel that was just up and really identified all the key issues. Just to mention that... five of my member companies here in Oregon are official participants in the Smart Growth Coalition: Intel, Tektronix, Electroscientific Industries, FEI, and TriQuint. So those are all, with the exception of Intel, which is actually has its largest presence here in Oregon, even though it is headquartered down in California. Those are proud homegrown Oregon high-tech companies that we'd like to keep around for some time. And really, in the case of ESI and Tektronix, are the two oldest high-tech companies in Oregon. In the case of Intel, the largest high-tech company in Oregon. So strong support from a number of members from our industry for this proposal, and they are working together with the Smart Growth Coalition.
Okay. So, thank you very much. What I would like, Representative Bernhardt?
Mr. Chair, Mrs. Carlson, who was here and testified on the last
bill.
Had to leave, but she asked me to indicate that her testimony on this bill would have been the same.
Okay. And as I would imagine, Chuck Sheketops would have been as well. Let's do this. We're out of time. We do have the comparative revenue impacts, both static and dynamic through OTIM, on these bills. Maybe, Paul, what we could do is set all of these again someday next week, just for the purpose then of having committee discussion about the revenue impacts and getting some information from staff as to those revenue impacts. And then if we want to schedule what we heard on Tuesday for the same kind of discussion at the same time, that's sort of like, I feel like we're kind of playing the bachelor game. You know, we got all these beauties that we've got to line up, and eventually you probably can't have them all, so we're going to have to make some choices here. But having all those revenue impacts before us and to talk about them in one meeting would be helpful, I think, than to recap the testimony from this week. Very good. I want to thank everybody, and especially those of you who stayed to the, I won't say bitter end, but to the tired end. This has been a good discussion. I appreciate your staying with us and your helping us with information today. So with that, in committee, I want to thank you for your attentiveness to this as well. We are adjourned until about 9 o'clock or so tomorrow morning.
Can you open the door?